Hello, salutations. Welcome to the TetraCast. This is episode 435. I am your substitute host, once again, Josh Torres. Brian, your usual host, is still out on vacation, and that's all good and dandy. Joining me for this episode, we have Adam Vitali.
Hello.
You have Xiaomin Wu.
How's it going?
You have James Galizio.
Hey, folks.
And you have Mikhail Madnani.
Hello.
So this week, we've had an interesting array of events and headlines coming out for games that were coming to our purview. We have that Xbox Developer Direct event. I forgot exactly how they call it.
Partner Preview.
That's right. Partner Preview. We have a few interesting things happening in prices of hardware that we're going to get into. And a whole other array of miscellaneous headlines. But before all of that, as for new releases, there wasn't anything particularly significant, aside from, I believe, Mega Man Star Force Legacy Collection came out. And Junior reviewed it for us. I don't think anyone on here has touched the collection aside from Junior. Am I correct on that?
No, I've played.
Oh, you played it too,
oh, Mikhail has.
Yeah, I was thinking. I was like, oh yeah, you did it for the comparison and all that stuff. But we'll get into that in a little bit. But other than that, Junior unfortunately couldn't make it, and we're here. We did also have Dissidia Duellum Final Fantasy release on mobile, which I can speak to just shortly. But before that, I guess the main game that I just put up is a little game coming out in a few days. I think it's like March 30th or March 31st, called Aether and Iron. Let me go check the Steam page real fast to see who were the developer publisher on this. Because last year I got the chance to develop like the narrative lead on it at PAX West, and we had a pretty lengthy interview about. Their upcoming game. So this coming out, end of March. This is developed by Seismic Squirrel and Chaos Theory Games, and also self-published by Seismic Squirrel. It's a pretty interesting game. The setup for it is it's like a 70% adventure game and 30% strategy RPG, but it's all done through like car combat. So all battles in it take place like on some sort of road or highway. And all that sort of stuff. And the setup for it is you are playing this smuggler named Gia Randazzo, and you reside in this alternate timeline of New York, which is like a more sci-fi version of it. It's basically, what if New York and kind of the rest of the world found this almost unlimited energy resource called Aether? So Aether allows for like, you know, cars to like hover off the ground, and like, and getting enough Aether was able to, you know, have the city of New York, instead of being like all grounded, it's all like floating islands. And so this version of New York in Aether and Iron is, you know, not so subtly separated by the societal ladder, where you have the uppers, which are like, you know, for wealthy, well-off people, very nice, high above. And below that are three floating island districts called the Lowers. And these districts all have, like, are run by different barons, have their own different social dynamics.
Is this like futuristic New York, or is it more like retro future?
It's more like retro future in the sense that, like, you do have like that sort of like, what is that like? I 1930s aesthetic to it.
Like, yeah, but flying cars. Yeah, that's why I asked, because like looking at the art style, it doesn't look like, you know, the year 2200 or whatever. It looks like, you know,
right,
the 1900s, but with flying cars.
Yeah, yeah, and so the when you begin the game, Gia takes up this job to go meet with this scientist named Eleanor, who goes by Nelly. And you don't really, like, this is almost like a simple escort job. Like, hey, and Nelly is with this mysterious briefcase. You just got to transport her to one place to another, and that was supposed to be the job. After this initial encounter and getting her to where she needs to go, you know, they, like, Gia realizes, oh, there's more baggage to Nelly. Someone's clearly tailing her. And as they, you know, shortly after they meet up, the car with the briefcase that Nelly, you know, is supposed to, you know, take from one place to another, it gets swiped, both Gia's car and Nelly's briefcase. And so you kind of have this, you embark on this adventure where you're not only searching for these items, which you kind of find early on, but it becomes more than that in terms of, like, hey, what is, like, really going on here in the story in terms of, like, why are we going on this adventure between, like, primarily these three district in the lowers. Forgot exactly the name of each section of the lowers here, but they all have different barons. So there's like an act one, act two, act three scenario. I'll be reviewing it in a few days. I'm not quite done with it yet. I'm like in the last stretch of the game. But it's a really fascinating game in terms of, like, at first you'll think it looks like this Disco Elysium, so you'll have expectations that it's Disco Elysium because you do have that visual presentation style where you have prose going at, like, the right side of the screen, you know, and dice rolls on making decisions. But I think it's really, even though it has, like, a visual presentation that is akin to Disco Elysium, the dynamics and flow of it is very different because it's like you're not really as introspective as you are Disco Elysium, where in Disco Elysium it's a lot of, you know, you're having conversations with yourself at the different sides and psyches of your main character in that, while Gia is, like, and the decisions you make in Aether and Iron are definitely more of a traditional narrative where you are responding to situations and people who are talking to you, and less about, like, having conversations in Gio's head. She does monologue here and there, but you're never really doing dice rolls of, like, what Gia is gonna do based on the monologue based in her head, which Disco Elysium like to do.
Now, is there a combat at all? Or is it all, yeah, like, decisions? Okay.
So, there's no on-foot combat. All the combat is done with cars. So as you're going from place to place, right, you go on these, like, when you go from place to place, there's, like, an overhead map, and there's, like, a node you need to get to. So you click on that node, and as your little pip starts traveling and then through the road, sometimes you'll have, like, surprise encounters or something like that, which these aren't necessarily random battles. Usually there's some sort of event, but some events down the road, or, like, some story events, will lead to a confrontation on the road. So it's not like as you're going from place to place, there's random battles, but sometimes some of these surprise encounters may lead to, you know, a battle, depending on your decision there. Because some of them are like, you're trying to go past a checkpoint, and you fail the die roll to get through it, you know, safely, or to pay your way out of it. Like, they'll be on your tail as you brute your first your way through it, and that will initiate a combat encounter. The battles are interesting in the sense that, like, it's not like the main focus of the game, but it definitely has enough RPG chops in the combat to make it, like, something you can't dismiss. Like, you have to really think about, like, your setup and, like, almost the builds of your cars. So the basic setup of them, it's like an isometric view. You have a certain amount of AP to work with, and you can travel on the road with the use of AP. But if you're traveling in reverse through the road, you use very little AP. So if you're going from, like, if you're just decelerating, you use, like, way less AP movement wise than you would going forward and accelerating. If you try to go accelerate, that uses a lot of your AP just for movement. Unlike when you're decelerating, let's say you go back in a straight line, like, four tiles, that uses no AP. But if you deviate, like say to the left or right during your deceleration, it'll use like 1 or 2 AP depending on how much you move off of that line. And if you try to accelerate forward, you are looking at like AP amounts of like 4 to 6, even 7 to 8 AP depending on how much you want to move forward. So that's a consideration you have to make of like positioning is like a very big thing in combat. And then also all your tools on your car, like for example, all cars have a ram option. So that consumes 2 AP. You can only do it once per turn. All your abilities you can only do once per turn. And as you ram into someone, you can reposition them, but you'll also take a little bit of damage yourself when you do that. But then there's also combat options like guns, like a shotgun, for example. In Gia's starting car, like she can only shoot left or right, so she has to be either either to the left or right side of like an opponent to use that that shotgun, for example, because she can only shoot horizontally out of that. But then, you know, later on, as you encounter like more like a new companion or new cars, you'll get options to shoot like vertically instead, like in front of you or behind you instead of just the side. And then there are some options that are like omnidirectional. So as long as you're adjacent to the enemy car, you can just use your ability regardless of position as long as you're near them. But then there's also ranges to some combat options, like a pistol, for example. You can only shoot like right next to you, while like a scout rifle, you can be like 2 tiles off of them and still be able to reach them. So there's like a heavy positional element. There's ranges to your weapons, and there's, you know, AP management as well on top of that.
Yeah, so I'm looking at a screenshot right now showing like I see like the like almost like a highway with a bunch of cars on it with like I think a turn order at the top and, you know, the AP that you mentioned and health and whatnot. But would you say that like this combat is something that happens frequently, or is it just kind of an occasional mechanic that pops up here and there?
An occasional mechanic, like I mentioned, like a 70% adventure game, 30% car game. But there, like, it's definitely you. It's not something you can ignore. It's definitely something that's not like,
right?
Something that's like you mind off. It's definitely something you have to be mindful of, especially as you progress through the game, as these encounters get trickier. Because as you're traveling along the road, there's usually like things that are marked on the ground to say, "Hey, there's an upcoming hazard here." So there's even like a consideration for like, okay, I want to make sure I position my vehicle, obviously not in a hazard zone. Or I can bump this car or ram this car into the hazard zone. So even though I don't do a lot of damage this turn, the upcoming environmental hazard will do just enough damage to finish them off instead in that regard.
I'm actually reading some impressions that Hayes wrote up for the Indie Informer. Mm-hmm. He also contributes to our site. And he was saying that also in the car battles, there's also just like civilians that you need to watch out for.
Yeah. There's like bystander cars as well, which that are also like something you have to be mindful of, especially when you're moving, because you can't move past cars. You can't phase through them. You have to move around them. So there'll be times where like, okay, if I want to move up or move down and this car's in the way, I have to use additional AP to maneuver around them. But that also goes both ways for your opponents too. So in a way, you can use them as obstacles for your opponents, so they burn up more AP reaching you, for example. In that regard, so there's a lot of like moving gears that are like I find really fascinating with the combat, because while it's like it's simple on the surface, there's like a lot of tactical decisions you do have to make that are impactful in that regard. And then you do get like fun options as you progress through skill trees for your not only Gia but her additional party members that join her party. Like these skill trees are dual faceted in the sense that like For Gia, for example, she has 3 main branches that she can use. She has like smarts. I'm trying to think of like it's like yellow, blue, and I think it was like was it purple or red? But like it's like different specializations of like I can speak well. I'm good with tools, or I'm like a brawler type of thing. But then each of these three main trees also branch out into three different specializations, and that's actually where like the real like you know your linear tree starts. So you can as you're progressing down one of these like one out of nine for Gia, these skill I guess lines. Let's say smooth talker, for example. The smooth talker line, as there will be minor nodes when you level up, you get like a skill point. You can get plus one to your smooth talker skill. So like if there's any options or that have that employ the smooth talker ability, you get like an additional you know die roll to add on to like your result off of like the dice roll. So let's say I invested like plus two into smooth talker and I roll five on that roll and add plus two to for a grand total of seven to and for the final result of that die roll, which can be helpful. But also along that smooth talker line, I'll also get combat abilities. For smooth talker, it's like you get additional AP to start off each round with Gia. So that's really helpful as well, because not only do I get the bonus die roll for smooth talker options, but also in combat, I now have more AP to work with Gia when it's her turn. So I can stack her up on weapons and abilities that may be more costly on the AP side, but I can afford it because Gia now starts with bonus AP thanks to that decision I made with the smooth talker. While there are other like vastly different trees. Like there's another party member that you get, and I have her as like almost the medic of my team. I put her down like a skill tree line that specializes in healing. When healing allies, she refunds some AP back, and so I filled her vehicle up with like these crane arms, and those crane arms are. You can use those as like the healing abilities of the game. So she has like an AoE heal, a specialized heal that heals more on a single target, and like another generic zone heal. So she's just like a mega medic.
Now, do these other party members basically like hang out with you once they join your party like all the time, or is it more like just like they're guests in certain spots of the game? Or are they pretty much just stuck with you once they join?
They stick with you for the most part. There'll be some story sequences where they might be doing their own thing temporarily unavailable for very briefly, but for the most part, they stick with
you. Okay.
And they do participate in the story as well. So there's a lot of things you have to consider for party composition. You can feel safe knowing that whatever you're building up, they won't like abandon you or anything. Yeah. So and it's interesting also because each party member also has skill trees, but it's not the usual three that Gia gets. They have two off to work off from, but they still have that three additional branches off of those two. So while Gia has the full breadth of abilities available to her, those party members usually only have like one is omitted depending on their specialty and all sort of stuff. But it's interesting because you could have those party members. Let's say the second party member, I also put down the smooth talker tree, for example. And Gia is also on the smooth talker tree. You can actually like stack up like your die roll bonuses if you have like two characters specialize, or even more specialize in like that. Say like that smooth talker tree. So you can get like say up to like maybe. Like plus four, plus five bonuses when you're doing a smooth talker option. While also they get the benefit of additional AP if you choose that option. Obviously, you're foregoing other like tree options for specializing into that one. So you do get like an additional bonus if you decide to like have everyone specialize like in like the same specific tree. And that does really feel like it comes to play like. Way later in the game where like the die rolls are getting even more difficult, even if like I have Gia maxed out on the smooth talker, usually that's not enough to trivialize the smooth talker options. Like usually, like there'll be the occasional option where like it'll only just be like a medium chance, even though she's like hyper specialized alone in that tree. So there are benefits if you so choose to having multiple characters specialize in the same one, because there are harder die rolls and decisions later on for sort of that sort of stuff. And of course, there's usually like consumables as well. Like if you fail a die roll, there's consumables that you can buy or that you earn that you can re-roll an option if you have those items on hand with you. In terms of like just the general flow of dialogue and the character interactions, I really, really, really like this cast. Like the whole when they start introducing everyone and kind of their own dynamics and the way that they interact with each other, they're all very like interesting in their own way, different enough, and have pretty like interesting backstories that the game tells you about in a very organic manner. It's like it's not like something that like they're expositing to you. It's something that is brought up pretty naturally in dialogue, which I really like. And there's a lot of optional character interactions that I even go out of my way to do, because you get like more, you can get more additional info if you go out of your way to kind of start prodding people about like, oh, like tell me about like this district, or like what was your history here, all that stuff. The way that the dialogue and the character interactions are written, it's one of the smoothest like adventure games I've read in terms of like how interesting each character interaction is, and like how well it's delivering its story to the player it's easy to consume and like kind of just digest. It doesn't feel impenetrable. They're not like, I don't feel really lost in what it's trying to tell me, which sometimes some, you know, adventure games do have like go heavy into their lingo and have to think about like, oh yeah, what did that mean again? Like this one is pretty smooth about it.
Yeah, and sometimes adventure games or like CRPGs feel like there's just a ton of text and maybe reading through it. But yeah, like either whether it's like volume or like you said, maybe jargon can sometimes get kind of almost like feels like a hurdle to get through it. So it's right. Like it's great when games like this or of course Disco Elysium have a lot of text, but just due to the quality of the writing, just due to the, you know, how interesting it is, and you know, maybe avoiding pitfalls like jargon too much can make it so you end up, you know, kind of losing track of time perhaps as you are reading all these dialogues and descriptions and whatnot.
Yeah, and the cool thing about this is also it's like it's fully voice acted too. There's a lot of voice acting in this game. More than you'd think. And it's like I can't remember like really a significant single time that like there was no voice acted line. Maybe like if like it was like narrating like some sort of action, like this person went to go do this, of course that wouldn't be voiced. But I feel like other than that, like all the character interactions in this game like are fully voice acted, especially Gia herself, obviously. Very, very chatty, very, even like when she's thinking to herself, she reads it all aloud. And it's like it's a very all the voice talent in this game are like pretty spectacular. Like there's I don't think there's a single voice that really irritated me. They're all very in character, very captures like the spirit of New York well in that sense too. Like obviously you'll definitely have like some accents here and there, and you'll have the occasional like Italian into the mix for some of these characters. And I think the only thing that really caught me off guard, and they might have hot-fixed this already because I'm playing on a pre-release version that they've been, you know, hot-fixing behind the scenes up to release, but there was some dialogue early on that, like, the sound mixing was off, so some lines were definitely way overblown or louder than the rest. In that regard, I wonder if they hot-fixed that. I haven't checked yet. But that's really the only significant thing in terms of like that part of the game that really stuck out. There's also some voice lines that it's very rare, but there are definitely some voice lines that don't match up exactly with what the text is saying. They might have like had like a set an additional line, or something might have been abridged, or something like the text is still similar to what they're saying, but not exactly what was being said. I saw some of that in early on. as well. I think the thing that does kind of irritate me, but you know, I hopefully they get this fixed up either by release or shortly after release, is so, like the menu navigation isn't like the most responsive sometimes when you're like getting back to like the like open map or like opening up a menu. There is like a slight like delay between like when it's open and when you can interact with it. It kind of feels sticky in a way that's like it's like non-responsive. You have to kind of wait for it first to like load up, and then you can do stuff in that regard. So there's like kind of this weird sort of incohesiveness between like when you're interacting with menus in that game. And it's going to be more, I've been playing it on controller, but like keyboard and mouse is definitely the smoother play, because it is the way that the inventory management is done in this game is very CRPG-ish, where like you can drag and drop stuff into, like, you know, when you're selling stuff, when you're buying stuff, and you do have like limited inventory space. And this is one of the things that like is interesting about the game too, because you can actually like, when you go into garages of this game and you're switching out like different parts for your vehicle, and for like for some characters, like each character has like a specialized, like, you know, these are the vehicle classes they can ride. You can even like swap characters into like a different class of vehicle, whether it's like a lighter vehicle or a more heavy vehicle that can dish out like, you know, more punishment and carry heavy weapons, or like something that's like lighter, quote unquote, on its wheels and do have light weapons. Like even when you're swapping out different vehicles and different parts for these vehicles, which all dictate like, you know, how much health you have or how much AP you have, and the obviously your different weapons and the different abilities you get for a character's skills, you can also attach storage on them to get more inventory space. Obviously storage also contributes to weight, and there's only a max weight limit on your vehicles, so you're even having to make decisions like, okay, like I want to have more storage space to carry more stuff so I can like sell them back at my base or stuff like that. So I have to maybe make considerations of like, okay, maybe I want this character to drive like a larger vehicle to have more to accommodate more storage space that I can bolt onto it. And there are also mechanics like concealed inventory and non-concealed, because there are checkpoints as you're traversing through the map that will actually do inspections of like whether you're carrying contraband or not. And contraband is really good for selling, but some contraband is like takes up a lot of space. You might want like inventory space that like has like bigger inventory slots that are concealed, but obviously that'll cost you more money if you want to get that as well. So there's even like a like inventory management in terms of like, you know, like not as crazy as like Resident Evil 4 Tetris, but there is a little bit of Tetris in regard of like when you're optimally like sorting out your item inventory slots between your three up to three different characters in combat and with their own inventory space on their personal and their vehicle. So it's a pretty cool game. There's also like a heat mechanic as well, where some actions in the game will get you'll accumulate heat, whether it's like picking a certain action or bolting on like a heavy weapon that's like very, you can't conceal that. You'll see like a grenade launcher on top of this vehicle, so of course like you'll attain some heat for that. And this heat will make it trickier to get past checkpoints safely, because you do have like, it's like almost a notoriety system, but it can also serve as like another additional stat roll or roll like bonus for like doing like braver actions. So like you'll see like when you're doing a die roll, you'll see the exact breakdown of like, okay, here's why that you got this number on a die roll. You have Gia's skill onto this, or another character's skill that's adding on to this like bonus, plus, you know, like depending on the condition, we get like an additional one or minus one like bonus or penalty. And then you'll have like a heat also contributes to it, so heat will sometimes work for you because you're taking a more bolder action, but it also might work against you if you're trying to do an action that is stealthy by nature, so you might get like additional bonus or penalty depending on that. So heat is also a mechanic that you goes into play with your die rolls.
I definitely appreciate having the the game itself, the transparency show you how all the different numbers and stats and characteristics show you how the roll result plays out versus having to do all that, you know, in the head. Very RPG there.
Yeah. And I really just appreciate the general, like, writing in this game in terms of, like, the narrative they're trying to tell, where you're eventually you're going to, like, fight for something, and you have, like, a cause, an ideal, and eventually you join, like, a band of companions and start, you know, working with them to achieve some goals. And I'm keeping this all a bit vague to not spoil anything. But it is definitely saying a message about, like, you know, it is okay to fight for a cause, and they are very, it's very mature about the way that, like, how people interact with each other. Like, people don't take for each other as, like, they don't, like, talk to each other as if they're dumbasses. They don't talk to each other as, like, they, like, you know, are clearly below them. It's very, it's pretty level-headed and very fair in the way that they kind of interact as people that have differing goals and have but are kind of, like, obviously they're trying to find a way to resolve things in a way that won't hurt the broader, like, it's not stupid about it, I guess, is the way that they're trying to do it, which is, you know, some games do fall into where, like, it feels like they're trying to talk down to the player because they're afraid that, like, the player might not understand what it's going for. While this game is very in line with sort of like, it doesn't treat its readers as if they're, like, they can't comprehend what it's trying to say or what it's trying to get at with these characters, which I really appreciate. And it does find ways to add additional details into, like, the world building without getting in the way of, like, its narrative storytelling. So, for example, you might run into a library at some point in the game, and, like, each of, like, the library, like, the shelves you can interact with optionally, of course, and you can read up more about, like, different topics about the world that they crafted if you want to. Like, it's like, if you're really curious about more of, like, how they built this world, they do find avenues to tell more about it, because I'm sure they had, like, a lot of ideas they wanted to, like, put into this game, and obviously along the way they had to cut some stuff, but for other ways they still found, like, an avenue. Hey, we still want to share this part of the world with the reader because we're enthusiastic about it, and I really appreciate that part of it. It's like, honestly, like, that with some technical, you know, jank aside, like, I think this is definitely one of my favorite games this year so far. Like, it's just, I can't say enough good things about it, even though there aren't, you know, even though it's, like, it's still kind of shaky technically in terms of, like, you know, like, the menus not being as responsive as I want it to be and the sound mixing and stuff like that. But it is such, like, a unexpectedly, like, captivating game. Like, I really, really dig this game.
Yeah, I want to get to it eventually, both this and Esoteric Ebb, which that one, yeah, I understand is that one I understand is a bit more directly Disco Elysium like, but apparently it does a pretty darn good job. I think Bloomberg even had a kind of feature on it.
Other than that, I also checked out a little bit of the newest Dissidia entry, Dissidia Duellum, Final Fantasy. So I was, like, wondering, like, what kind of game this is. Like, even though I know people described, like, you know, how it played during the closed beta when it was going on, I was like, I still don't really have a good grasp on it. I even got invited to that closed beta, but I just didn't have time to get around to it. So I was like, okay, I'll just check it out. It's fine. So it is like a three, like, it's a PvPvE game where two teams of three are competing against each other. So like, as a match starts, like, you know, you could be Cloud, you could be Renoa, you could be who else was in this game, Lightning, or whatever, like, it has a starting roster, and you, as the match starts, yeah, it could be you and some bots or you and, like, two other people. It's, like, usually live PvP VE, and as that match starts, you are going to these, like crystal nodes around the map, and these crystal nodes have several, like, two to three monsters surrounding them, And as you move around with the like a virtual joystick, you can like, you know, just standard movement like on your screen. Like it's there's like a zone on your screen that like you, that will, that shows this will accept commands here. So like you move your thumb in that little zone on your screen to show that like you can move the character. You can also enable like auto movement in the game if you want. And as you approach these monsters, there's like a circle underneath your character, and anything in that circle, your character will auto attack. So you don't have to like, you know, like mash a button to auto attack, but if as you're auto attacking, you can mash, you can button tap that zone that I was talking about, and it'll do increased damage if you know, tap along with your auto attacking. So okay, fine, whatever. So as you defeat like the 2 to 3 monsters on these crystal nodes that are like, you know, throughout the map, they're like almost like capture points, like in the FPS. You bust open the crystal automatically after you defeat these 2 to 3 monsters, and then everyone in your team gets this resource called bravery. Throughout the series, the Cydia series, bravery has always been an important central resource for the games. Like in the other games, like, you know, you needed to, in order to do HP damage to anything in those games, to like whittle down the life of anything, you needed to build up bravery and then do an attack that will consume the bravery, and whatever bravery amount you had, let's say you had like, you know, 5,000 bravery, you'll do 5,000 HP damage then if your attack connects. And like in throughout all of the Cydia games, that was like a central like rule of it.
Then this mechanic sound is very similar.
In this game, it's fundamentally different though. So bravery, like the bravery amount that you get, nothing matters except 9999 bravery in this game. So okay. you are going around trying to build up 9999 bravery as fast as possible, whether it's through these crystal smashing these crystals at their nodes to build up to that, or you can like defeat another enemy to get their bravery, which is also a staple of other Dissidia games. You defeat someone like in Dissidia NT, you would get their bravery, I believe. Or yeah, I think you observed their bravery.
Or at least you raised it somehow.
Yeah, definitely. But in this one, you did like whatever bravery amount they had, you've absorbed it. Because you want 9999 bravery, because there's a boss that spawns very early into the match, like around the center of that map, whether it's like a behemoth or Marlboro, one of the, you know, classic boss monsters in Final Fantasy. And the real objective to win the match is to whittle down the HP of that boss before the enemy team does. So when this boss spawns, there'll be a boss HP at the left side of the screen and a boss HP at the right side of the top of the screen. And you'll see both of these bars. That is the boss HP for each team. So whoever whittles down the boss HP of their team first wins the match. So it's not like you're working together with the opponents to whittle down one universal HP bar. No, no, no. It's working with your team of three to whittle down your boss's HP first before the enemy team does. And the only way to damage this boss is to activate this burst mode first that only is activated once you achieve 9999 bravery. If you try to attack it any time before that, all your abilities, all your normal attacks will just bounce right off and it'll be ineffective. So it is a rush to get to that burst mode, and then you're only in this burst mode for a very limited amount of time. So it's very much like, once you get to 999 bravery, activate burst mode, fire off all your abilities at the boss monster, and then you'll get like a bigger like damage bonus if you are doing that in tandem with your other teammates. So you can like, you know, you can do a lot of damage if you're working together on that end. But you're also trying to manage like making sure that the enemy team isn't trying to steal your bravery as well, because obviously they're going to try to gank you if they see like, hey, a lot of these people have like high bravery amounts. We have to deny them trying to damage their cash out their damage. trying to make sure that we're, you know, we get there first. So it is this kind of almost tug of war mechanic where you're managing the income resource of you, your opponents, and obviously doing damage to the boss through, you know, doing the crystal nodes, accumulating bravery there, or stealing bravery from the other team. And that is the core of the game.
I have a dumb question. So this game was described as 3v3 boss battle game, which, based on what you're describing, that how you're describing it now, that makes sense. Like, it's 3v3, you're like opposing teams kind of fighting each other and a boss. I don't really play these sorts of mobile games. Is this pretty unique, or are there like other games with this sort of like structure? Because I hadn't really heard of
unique in that regard. Yeah, like
I hadn't really heard of a game like this with this like goal where you're fighting another team to fight a boss.
Like the closest I can sort of think of is like even MOBAs in that regard aren't really that structured like that. It's similar in concept, but you're trying to wipe out the enemy team in that regard still, but they're structured and not necessarily being the first one to defeat a boss first. Maybe. What was that Capcom not Dino Crisis, but the one that they released and
Exo Primal.
Like I believe Exo Primal had a mode where it had like a PvPvE element to it. I don't even think it's like that close to that. So it's pretty unique in that regard, where I struggle to immediately find like a cornerstone of like what game is this most similar to. In that regard, so it is pretty unique in that regard. But like, this would have been really cool as like, hey, if this was like a normal release. But in order to get abilities for your characters, so after the tutorial of it, you can start with either Warrior of Light, Cloud, Lightning, or I believe was it Terra was the other one. And you can choose either their normal, you know, clothes that they wear in their games, or like the modern urban outfit that's new to the city of Dwellum. Having a different outfit doesn't change anything. It's just like the way they look. That there's no statistical advantage or anything having one outfit over the other. After you make this selection, you get into a tutorial roll, an infinite reroll of abilities, where you roll 10 abilities at a time. That, you know, rare, super rare, or super super rare SSR rarities, and if you don't like what you get out of these 10, you can re-roll it. So it's definitely, I forget if it's like SSR or UR in this game. It might be NR, SR, SSR, and UR actually is for your rarity. And in this, unlike other infinite rerolls in other mobile games, because usually in those ones that offer one, you are the result will always have at least one like SSR or UR equivalent, but never more than that, usually in those games. While in this game, you could have multiple URs in that role, and there's no cap to it. So there's definitely been times, if you're patient enough, where you can get like 2, 3. I've even seen like a crazy screenshot where someone got a god reroll of like 7 URs. I don't know if that's fake or not, but I saw a screenshot. I'm like, that's funny. And these abilities, URs, most of the time are character exclusive. So each character has 2 UR abilities that you can obtain, whether it's through this infinite reroll if you're patient enough, or through getting lucky on other subsequential roles. And they're usually pretty powerful. Like, you know, both Cloud and Lightnings have like very powerful offensive skills that will do a shit ton of damage to the boss, which like obviously you would want if the goal of the game is to take out the boss before the other team. Then there are some other characters which are more utility based. Like, I believe Trance Mode isn't that useful, so Zidane, you know, I'm not sure how that useful it is in that regard. I know the one that Terra turns into like the spirit form, was it Esper, I believe? I heard that's not great either. So even some of these characters, like their character exclusive abilities, even though they're higher rarity, like it seems like at least how the meta is shaking out right now, from what I understand. Anything that's like not whittling down the boss's HP as fast as possible, not great, relatively speaking. But let's say I pick lightning for the tutorial. I can roll this infinite reroll thing. I can even if this wasn't an infinite reroll, I can roll this and have there can be sometimes where there's a roll where there are no useful abilities for you at all. You might, let's say you got like an awesome 2 UR roll, but both of those abilities are for Warrior of Light and Zidane. Lightning can't use any of those, so okay, I don't really care. Tough luck. If it's not an infinite reroll, then tough luck, you know? You get Warrior of Light or Zidane on like the character tickets instead. And I'll get into that in a little bit. But you know, there are other abilities that are like, you know, there are some UR abilities that are not character exclusive, like, which are funny because they have characters on them that are not playable. Like Selfie, for example, there's a Selfie UR ability card that's like Wall. And Wall is pretty good on paper because it has like, for a limited amount of time, you have like an 80% increase in defense. So obviously you want to activate this card, like say for PvP encounters, and you want to, you know, make sure you're taking as less damage as possible while trying to dish out, you know, trying to steal bravery from the other team. There's also one like for Ace from, what's it called? I still call it my Agito 13. What is it called?
Type zero.
Yeah, I still call it Agito. Wow. Yeah, God, I'm so old.
The Agito turned out to be like a different game entirely that I don't remember if that ever went.
Well, was it like a mobile game? A flip phone?
It was a flip phone game. Yeah. But you're thinking Type Zero Ace, right?
Yeah. Some of these UR cards have characters that on them that have abilities, but they're not playable. So they're just universal cards. But then, you know, you have your SSR cards, which are like, you know, your higher tier spells like Faraga, Thundaga, etc., and so on. There'll be some heals here and there if you want. But, you know, you were constructing, like, I believe your character can have up to 6 active skills, and then there are support slots as well that you can slot in skills into them, but it won't, like, that support slot set for them is only for statistical value. You cannot actually use the skills that you slotted to support. It's just adding the numbers of those cards onto your character stats. That's it, pretty much. So you're working with up to 6 abilities. Obviously, having good character exclusive ones will help as well, especially if they have, like, you know, their UR cards, which are extremely powerful. So, you know, so this is the decision calculation you want to make. It's like, okay, in this starting infinite reroll for abilities, do I want to spend hours rerolling for like a good roll that like I can actually use with my character, or do I just want to spend a few minutes and work with what I have? And then whatever you decide, whether that'll take hours or days or whatever, getting the perfect roll for your character, you go onto the character gotcha. So it's a separate gotcha, but this one's still, I believe, also an infinite reroll, so you can get another character, playable character, that's beyond the starting 4 selection. So if you want Gaia, Zidane, I already forgot who's in this game.
More real life. was it Krell from Final Fantasy V?
Redoa, whatever. Yeah, whoever else you want beyond the 4, you can infinitely reroll for that character in this one. So if you didn't like any of the starting 4, and let's say you got good UR abilities for, like, you know, beyond the starting 4, here's the gotcha where you can infinitely reroll for that character. So at least you can start off the game with like generally a character that you really wanted to play and abilities that you can work with if you were willing to reroll enough to, you know, roll for that. And the character gotcha is funny because after you're done with these infinite rerolls for abilities and an additional character, there's this promotion period right now in the game, like for however many weeks. If you do a certain amount of like rolls on the ability gacha banner, they'll give you like a one character ticket for reaching a certain amount of rolls, and that's like their promo period. And you can use this one character ticket to roll once of the character character gacha. And by the way, I should also mention the character gacha separates the game outfit and the urban outfit, like city outfit, as well into their own separate thing. So if I get Rinoa, for example, if I got her game outfit, that means I can only like I'd have to roll Rinoa again for her city outfit if I wanted that as well. So it's not something that like you get both outfits if you get the character. Like no. If you want a certain outfit, you better hope that you roll for it. Anyway,
so it's a skin gacha game, collecting cosmetics.
So, but here's the thing: I can consume that one character gacha ticket to obviously go roll into the pool of like all the characters and work with what I have. Or you can save, like, I believe 3 or 5 character tickets, and you can actually do like a buy the character outright if you are willing to spend multiple character tickets instead if you want that specific character. So you don't have to play the game of chance if you are willing to save up character tickets for them in that regard. I guess that's fine if you really want another character that you're going for and you're just willing to save character tickets for it. But as you're playing through these PvPvE matches, obviously early on, you're getting matched with bots. Eventually, you'll get matched with real people as you climb the ladder, etc. As you're playing through the game, you'll start leveling up your battle pass in the game. And this battle pass, you know, there's obviously a free track and paid track like many other games with battle passes, but this is also where you can unlock the story in the game. And the story scenes come in two forms. They're either like through text conversations with some characters, so you'll have like line chats, you know, with the characters, and then you'll have like more like bespoke traditional cutscenes where they actually have like a full 3D video of the characters interacting with one another in a scene. These are only obtainable as you're leveling up this battle patch, which is done through participating in these matches. And it's not like you can infinitely play these matches. I believe as you are playing, as you are finishing these matches, you consume a resource that eventually you'll like reach a point where you can no longer play new matches. I mean, you can play them, but you won't get the rewards from them. It tells you that. And they're like these little crystal node timers at the bottom that'll refill once they're refilled, you can now like get rewards from your next upcoming match. So there is still sort of like a stamina system in the game in that regard. So you can't just infinitely like replay them. Or you can't just infinitely play PvPvE matches.
So do you just have to wait?
Either you wait or you spend money to play to get the reward.
Cool.
In that regard. And I believe there's also like solo challenges as well. There's like some solo content that I didn't really get into. I just wanted to check out like, hey, well, I enjoy this game. And I think because eventually, I imagine, it'll get competitive up to the point where like you'll need dupes for abilities to like really excel. Because as you're getting dupes of an ability, it raises its level cap. So you can you do get like these growth points that you can use to level up abilities, but eventually like they'll cap out at like level 10. So you'll need an additional dupe of that ability to raise their cap to like 20, for example. So I imagine if you're trying to get, you know, competitive in this game, you will need dupes of like, I don't know about how the meta will shake out, but you'll definitely need dupes of like your most important abilities, whether they are UR or SSR rarity. You will need dupes of them to further level them up, so they can, you know, having a higher level means higher stats, which means they'll perform better. So it's definitely in that cycle of like, you know, if you want to excel, you're definitely going to have to get lucky on the gacha to raise the level cap of your most important abilities in that regard. And obviously there's many avenues of monetization this game, whether it's like buying the battle pass, buying like, you know, the bundles for, you know, more growth points or more whatever resource to power up your character more, or getting more currency to pull the gacha ability gacha to, you know, get the thing, like, you know, the abilities that you want. So, you know, that's the game model and the game that they wanted to make, and I'm just like, nah, I'm good. I've seen all I needed to see. I'm good. I still have, like, I actually played through the game a bit. Like, I played like maybe 5 to 6 matches, and then I was like, I wonder how long would it take for me to like get a role that has both of my like say Lightning's UR abilities in that single role in the infinite reroll. So I started over my game to get to that infinite ability reroll, and that game is still installed with that infinite ability reroll on, because I still have never gotten a role with both of Lightning's UR. Not to say that I spend all day rerolling it. I just like kind of do it one, like for a few minutes and then turn it off, and then just turn it back on and do infinite reroll. You know, when I want to like pass like maybe 5 minutes. Just to see. I did get one out of like, I don't know, God knows how many, that had both of Cloud's URs, but I was like, I don't have Cloud, I have Lightning, and Lightning is cool. And I still never got that. So, and it's also annoying too, because like the English font they use for like the line dot conversations is like really thin and not, it's really annoying to read on like a mobile screen. As well, like an iPhone 17 Pro thing or whatever, and that has like a decent screen size, but the font they use in this game is so annoying to read because it's so thin and so not, it like the letters don't stick out enough like on a small screen to like be easily like readable. I have to like kind of squint a little even read these line conversations. And there's like, you know,
I mean, remember the original font for the Pixel remasters?
Yeah, like, yeah.
And I know they updated that slightly, but like still not great. I don't even remember exactly what they did, yeah. But like at a glance, it's just kind of like, why is this the font? I don't know.
I know. Yeah. The one thing I will say that abused me the most about it was there are these, you can like create like character profiles. For you know, for your username, you can have like your username obviously, but also like your top 4 favorite characters and like a model of like, your playable character there. But you can also have like player tags on your character, like kind of describe like, you know, what are you a fan of, or like, you know, some of them are like, you know, like you know, let's be friends on X, or let's be friends on like streaming on Nico Nico, or come to Mirativ, and like, you know, you can send presents to like other people like on your friends list or your followers or whatever. Or who you're following, you can like send them like some like, you know, in-game currency, like, you know, coins, like not like gacha currency, but like, you know, or like growth points if you want to gift them, stuff like that. But you can also like have player tags of like, what are you like, what are you, a Final Fantasy 3 fan? Are you a Final Fantasy 6 fan? Are you a Final Fantasy, you know, 7 Rebirth fan? Are you like even some spin-offs, like, you know, are you a Final Fantasy, like, you know, Crystal Bearers fan or Final Fantasy Tactics fan or whatever? But then I saw some good ones that I put on my profile. I was like, I'm a New Empire fan, I'm a War for EOS fan, I'm a the First Soldier fan, and I'm a Dirge of Cerberus fan. Those are the 4 fan tags I have on my player tag in that first account that I got rid of.
Makes sense.
And I was like, that's pretty good. That's a really funny thing to just include in the game. Like, yeah, I'm a New Empire fan.
Yeah, you know, I saw someone share some of the games that are available. It's like, they're all Final Fantasy games, but like some deep cuts in terms of which Final Fantasy games you can pick.
Yeah, yeah. So it's just funny to see like those games that no traditional Final Fantasy fan has any love for, like the ones that are just like those like home base builder ones on mobile that like you accrue resources with time and just really not Final Fantasy at all. Just
this is kind of a fun, I guess, nugget. Almost 10 years ago, Chris wrote a kind of a review feature on Final Fantasy 15 and New Empire, which is one of those mobile, like, whatever those. But yeah, like the feature is called "I played Final Fantasy 15 and New Empire and spent money in it, so you don't have to." And for some reason, that article like exploded and like was getting like traffic and eyeballs for like years. Because I think it was like the only, we were like the only quote unquote major website who covered it. So it just kind of like anyone looking up anything about this game fell on that article. it was kind of like a shit post article, but basically just like, yeah, this game is bad. And it trafficked really, really well. We were not expecting that.
And that's the legacy we have now for it. But I also like the early story cutscene of like Rinoa and Angelo. Like, I'm always up for more Angelo in any Final Fantasy, so I'll give it that. Hey, there's a fucking 3D render of Angelo. Let's go! If for anyone doesn't know, that's Rinoa's dog, FFA.
Yep. So,
Angelo Rush. So yeah, that was all of like Rinoa's like special limit breaks, right? Like it's always Angelo related, aside from her angel one. It's all Angelo. Angelo's such a cool character. I like Angelo. That if they had like a fan of Angelo, I would put that on. But yeah, that's Dissidia Duellum Final Fantasy. It's not really the Dissidia game. I even like Dissidia NT2, the one that's the home port of the Dissidia arcade game. Like, my friends and I had a lot of fun with that, but it's just, it had so many problems with it in terms of like matchmaking and the netcode. And on the PC version, there's like, you could edit the stats on a, because it's all just stored in plain text.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I remember that.
That really sucked. But like the core fighting game system itself is like, was actually really fun. We enjoyed that part of it. So if it just was a better put together product, you know, we would have really fallen in love with it. But
on the side, like, that no one seems to be able to nail fighting game like matchmaking until like nowadays.
Yeah. This,
I don't know why it takes so long for people to figure that out.
Yeah. But I think most people these days want like, you know, like a home version of Opera Omnia. Like, that was a fun, like, turn-based spin on, like, the Dissidia system, and that had, like, a lot of characters throughout its tenure.
I remember that game having some also deep-cut characters, like some character from Final Fantasy XII Revenant Wings, which I have played.
Hell yeah.
I have played that game. I have beaten that game. I do not remember, like, the new characters. There was, like, a Winged Race. I don't remember what they were called. I'm sure there was some character with a name. I don't remember, but I remember they were in Opera Omnia.
Yeah. I think people are just crossing their fingers like, please, just leave the home port of this with all the characters.
I know we've said this before, but after Octopath Zero, seeming to work out pretty well, like Opera Omnia as well as Nier Reincarnation seem to be, from Square Enix anyway, the two mobile games that people would want. An Octopath Zero version of those, like a reconfiguration for, you know, consoles and PC.
And even podcast episode, but go for it, Kyle.
I was gonna say, no one cares about the Valkyrie profile and the Star Ocean that went missing.
I like Anamnesis. My friends especially are still very sore about Star Ocean Anamnesis not being a thing anymore. They really liked it. I played the Valkyrie profile one. That one is weird. I think I liked it, but it's very...
What was that one called again?
Anatomia, the Origin, right. I believe.
Yeah.
I think the one that kills that game, it was like there was some VIP pass, I believe that was.
Yeah, I remember that. You had a VIP pass, and just like, it's also weird because like, it gets very repetitive. There's like, you can only do Valkyrie Profiles battles so many times without like, if you're just doing it over and over and over and over again, it kind of gets old pretty fast. Like, you need something to really mix it up, and that game sort of didn't have that. But it did have a lot of fun collaborations, like, it had Full Metal Alchemist in it, and a whole bunch of other ones. So, that was an interesting game.
Full Metal Alchemist, it's the next Granblue collab.
It's Square Enix property, baby.
Yeah, well, at least it's not the Persona 4, I mean Persona 5 collab. Granblue already had. I know, I was saying that usually when you get one of those, that's the death of your game.
Nah, there's still some games that make it through. Like Another Eden had two of those.
Yeah, it survived.
But I was mentioning earlier, like even in this very podcast episode later on, we're going to talk about like, you know, another game that had mobile roots getting a home console release. But that has an interesting circumstances behind it. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But that, yep, that's Dissidia Duellum Final Fantasy. I really don't know if this game has like a life beyond, like a healthy life ahead of it, man. It just feels like the core of it is so, if you want to be competitive in, at some point, I feel like you're going to really need to invest in the gacha heavily, for better or for worse. So like, I mean, early on, it'll be fine up until the point, and I just don't know.
I'll take this opportunity to jump ahead to one of our later news bits. Square Enix did announce that War of the Visions Final Fantasy Brave Exvius is shutting down. Like, the global version already shut down, like, last year, but the Japanese version is shutting down in, like, a few months. So, you know, that was one of the, I forget how long running it was, like 6 years in Japan, maybe. But, you know, just another, there's been a lot of shutdowns for Square Enix mobile games. I'm trying to remember what they have remaining. You know, they have Ever Crisis, they have Ember Storia, that's still up.
Ember Storia.
I think Champions of the Continent is still going, even though that is now at NetEase.
Well, I think they're still managing it in Japan themselves.
Oh, Japan themselves is Square Enix, but the English version is NetEase, which I've seen some very, very good translation. And by good, I mean not good at all.
Yeah. And they also have, I believe, Record Keeper is still going on in Japan.
Oh.
Yeah, I think that's still chugging along.
Alex was a big fan of that one. Yeah.
That was Alex's
one mobile game.
I mean, I have a lot of friends who really liked Record Keeper too, and that was global. There's something about it that they really latched on, which is cool. But other than that, we have the upcoming Dragon Quest Smash and Grow one.
Oh yeah.
It's
like some weird like battle or roguelike thing.
Yeah.
I know there was a closed beta, which I know some people were like, this is pretty weird. know, not really what you think about when you think about Dragon Quest, but.
Like, whenever it feels like Square Enix is like winding down on mobile, they like announce and release two more. It's like, okay, what are we doing?
And like Ember Storia is like RTS, and it's got Kozaki as the artist, the Fire Emblem Awakening art, and a bunch of other things. And like that was released, I think, more than a year ago in Japan, and it's still going. I really don't know much about it. I don't think there's any plans for an English release, but that's a thing.
Yeah, I sort of fiddled around with that one when it first released Japan, but it's so reliant on like Japan time zone timers that's like it's really a fraught experience as like as if you're trying to VPN and like play it. That's like it's because like a lot of it is like base building, and all those are done on like real life timers. Like you do have to like wait X amount of minutes and hours for this construction to finish unless you use like an item to like instantly finish it, and then. Like out of the base building, you're like actually like raising an army that you take into like live PvP. So I believe like Ember Storia in that regard, there's like an appeal to people who like doing like guild versus guild, like faction versus faction, real time PvP. And that's the allure of it for them. I don't know how it is like the single player side, but I do know it does have like a pretty fierce like competitive side to it.
And as just to kind of put a bow on the War of the Visions bit. They actually said, the producer, Watanabe, actually said they had considered making an offline version of the game, but to quote Kite's article here, they found it difficult because the game's features required, like a lot of the features required an online connection, such as player interactions versus in guild content. So instead, they're preparing other ways to retain the story, like memorial books and videos. So that sounds like a game that will not have a console release. Like that's not even a consideration. They are going to do other things to hope so that
that's such an odd like reason to be, because like
that's what they said. That's what Kite's reporting
says. I have no doubt that obviously I have no doubt that they said that, but it's like the reasoning is like you can't just like a smaller scope release of like having the story and those story stages in it, and like having like recruiting characters like in a traditional way, like
Yeah, like, we all understand. Like, I played Octopath Zero. That is not going to have all the content from Champions of the Continent or all the characters, right? Like, I understand that. That's still fine.
Yeah, it's like, oh no, there's no live PvP in this home release of World of Visions. It's over. I actually did like watch a little bit of like live PvP tournaments, like the for World of Visions that were held. Like, it looked crazy, but it's not like an end of the world. It's like, oh, if you release it out the live PvP in the guild versus guild, what's left? It's like, I'm pretty sure there's more than that in it, but okay.
That's just the same like fucking viewpoint of people in like online competitive games where it's like, we don't want skill-based matchmaking because we don't want to sweat every match, when really what they're saying is, we don't want skill-based matchmaking so we can absolutely pub stomp.
Yeah.
I was gonna say, do you remember Sinnoh Alice where you're like, had to wait for the right time zone to kill
her? I did daily guild war in that game for like maybe 2 months. It was like me, Kazuma, and a good handful of my friends, like, did guild battles daily in that game for a good while, until we were all burnt out. Like, what the fuck are we doing? Like, we had like proper compositions and shit, and like actually like rolling for fucking proper gear in that game. It was fucking insane, man. Like, I, more than anything, like, for Sinnoh Alice, I'd rather not get like an anime adaptation, because I don't want to. I don't like the visuals really of that game. I think it wouldn't be conducive for like a home release, because like the single player part of that game was so, the storytelling was interesting, but the actual visuals and battle system of what you're doing wasn't really engaging.
It was a huge downgrade from the art.
Yeah. Like, I would rather just have an anime adaptation of that, because I really dig the characters and the world, like, it itself, and having that be as an anime would be freaking awesome. But that's, who knows?
Square Enix is listening, you know what to do.
Hey, I got Taro and Okabe to sign my Sinnoh Alice OST when I was in Chicago however many years ago at this point, and they were really surprised that they saw it there. Okay. Like, they're like, what the fuck? Why is there Sinnoh Alice here? Are you crazy? Like, yeah. But I think it's definitely one of my favorite OSTs from Okabe. I think Sinnoh Alice's OST, like, sour, like, music is, like, beautiful. I love it. Really, really good. Anyway, that's the City of Dwellum. That's also World of Visions being end of service. Other than that, we do have an op-ed by Hayes about the City of Dwellum. He got to check it out like pre-release and has shared his thoughts about it as well. And you know, largely mirrors what mine in that sense. Where like this is like I said earlier, like, this has a pretty interesting like format that like isn't, you don't really see this anywhere. It's not a common format, but obviously the mobile monetization side of it doesn't feel great. Before we while we're still on Final Fantasy, Mikhail, you decided to revisit Final Fantasy 12, the Zodiac Age, across several platforms, and wanted to see which one was the best version, just, you know, for people who want to revisit that game and are interested in what's the best version. What were your findings in that?
Yeah, so that was actually supposed to happen like a week before, but there was like a double, like a combo of Bravely Default's Shadow Drop and then the Switch boost mode thing which happened. So that actually contributed to this, because I was also able to test that. But yeah, the main takeaway from this is Square Enix is still really bad about feature parity with its remasters. The PC version still has like, is the only version which has access to the boosters for gil and license points, and also the fact that you can start New Game Plus and New Game Minus without having finished it. Like, that's not there in any other version. But yeah, it was very interesting to revisit this, because like, this is one of those games where it was first on PS4, then they ported it to PC less than a year later with like new features, new options, and then like a few years after that on Switch and Xbox with even more features, but not all the features. And then like a year or two after that, they just randomly patched the PS4 and PC version. So like, you have like multiple versions now, but the PC version is basically the best, because it was also like, I would say it's the, I think it's the best Final Fantasy port they've done also, because like every other port they've done since then has been iffy. Like Remake is still bad, Rebirth is still bad. 16 is very demanding. It's not a bad port from what I know, but it's just very demanding. 15, I think, was a good port. Again, very demanding. 14 is 14, but 13 is awful on PC without mods. So yeah, 12 is like no complaints at all. Like it has ultra-wide support also, pretty unheard of for like a remaster, especially compared to what they did for 10. So yeah, 12 is best on PC. But if you are curious about it on other platforms, I've like covered everything. And yeah, I just like cemented that this is in one of my is one of my favorite Final Fantasy games. And I had like I linked to Austin SV's YouTube video. Like he's one of my favorite YouTubers for platform comparisons and stuff, because he identified something which I didn't realize a few years ago when I played it, and that is that except for the PS4 version, they added cloth physics to the character models. The PS4 version never got that in patches, so the models look a little flat compared to the other platforms. So I linked that for because he found that out. I didn't even realize that when I was playing it on Switch a few years ago. So yeah, give that a read if you're curious about everything. And like doing those whatever comparison images also took a while, and like I tested all the load times. The only one thing I didn't test is I don't own the Windows Store version of 12, which is something I keep forgetting exists, because this was before they did the single purchase for Xbox and the PC version together. And I bought the Xbox digital and physical version, and oh yeah, I couldn't find my physical copy, so I didn't use it in the photo. And like some people who obviously didn't read the article were like, where's the Xbox version? Like maybe click it and read. So yeah
thank you for taking the time to do that. It's a pretty heavy endeavor on that. I was looking at Nexus mods for it. It still has a pretty active modding scene on PC, so surprised me.
I've been meaning to play the PC version. I remember when the PS4 version was coming out, like I was telling myself, I'm just going to wait for PC, but we needed someone to cover it at the time. And I was like, fine, I'll do it. I didn't really want to play the PS4 version, but I did. And since then, I've still been meaning to play the PC version. I know I'll love it. I love Final Fantasy XII. And the only other thing I'll say is, I remember in terms of like all the different updates that they kept adding as they kept porting the game, by far the most like crucial one, or like the most, you know, game-changing update was you can reset your classes and yeah, so like you can do that from like Mont Blanc at the guild. Before, like I remember when the game first came out on PS4, like the Zodiac Age, obviously that was the very first time there was like the class system was, you know, in an English version, right? Because in the original game that wasn't there, and it was like It was at the time, you're like, you make your decision and you are stuck with it. Like, and of course people are fretting, like, oh, they don't want to make the wrong choice or a bad choice or whatever. But now it's like, they've updated that. Now you can re-roll. I don't know exactly if there's any specifics in terms of how it's done, but I know you can do it. So that was a big update that they added.
I think the thing that I like when we're playing it, it was just like how fast-forward the game, because I remember playing the original PS2 version. It was like a slog to get through.
It's one of those things where like I loved the PS2 version when I played it, like the original version, but like the new version having like the x2 and the x4 like speed, especially with the way that combat system works, where you're setting up gambits, and if those are set up properly, you don't really need to like be actively, you know, engaging with battles all the time. You set up smart gambits and then you can just turn on the turbo mode and kind of just have your team fight for you. And it works out pretty well, actually. And it's like, now I can't imagine going back to the original version and not having the turbo. So that's a big advantage too, of course.
What are you saying, Mikael?
Yeah, just two things, actually. One is that it's still a bit funny that if you want to play on like home console, the PlayStation version is the only one which runs above 1080p, because it's like 1440p 30, but it's 30. The Xbox version was always 1080p, but it was 60 FPS. So it's like picking between both consoles is like choosing quality or performance mode. And if you play on Switch 2, like with boost mode, you get like a decent handheld experience now, but without boost mode, just in general, it's like really blurry. because they had to also like cut back a lot of textures. This was the time when Square Enix was doing physical releases on Switch. So they had to like compress a 30 or 40 GB game to fit inside a 16 GB cartridge. So they really cut back. Even the cutscenes are like lower quality. So yeah, like that's something to keep in mind. But the funniest outcome of this is discovering how awful the PS4 save system is for this game specifically. Like, you remember how on PS4, like stuff like Yakuza 0 or like older games, they have this dog shit thing where it'll do like saving system data, then you have to press OK, then it'll save the file and you have to press OK again. It used to take so long. But in FF12, it just takes like it was so bad that I actually added the load time, I mean the save time in my comparison for like the loading. And if you look at that, it's like 14 seconds to save on the PS4 Pro or the PS5 back compat. But if you play any other platform, saving takes either 1 second or less than 1 second.
That's
and
crazy.
I save a lot like manually in games. So like this was really annoying me. And I was like, how did I not realize this when I played it first? But yeah, like times were different back then. But yeah, that was... I can't believe they haven't fixed that after how many other patches it's gotten. It's just awful to save. Like insane, it takes 14 seconds to save on that. Even the Switch one takes 1 second. So yeah.
Especially if your save's coming to get certain drops.
Don't do it. The Zodiac Sphere raid isn't worth it. Okay. Then we also we have a review here from James. You did you did the Nintendo Switch 2 version of Kenna Bridge of Spirits.
Yeah.
We didn't know originally cover it, but I believe that it's within our.
We decided to cover it kind of after the fact.
Yeah,
covered after fact, and it's one of those things where what we've seen of the sequel, it feels like it's going to be more of an RPG, and even if we don't end up covering it at launch, maybe there will be other opportunities, is all I'll say. But I played it. Mikhail also played it, but reviewed it for Nintendo Insider. And first question I have for you, Mikhail. Did you adjust the motion blur when you checked it out?
Yes.
Okay. That default motion blur is insane.
Yeah. I think the game in general, like I read when I saw your review go up in the RSS feed, and I was like, I feel like both of us are the only people who came away like which had those takeaways with the port quality, because everyone else was like, I mean, like, everyone can have their own opinion, but I don't know, like, based on what you and I have played, I've seen, like, it being called as pristine image quality and stuff in some other, like, discussions, and I'm like, no. Like,
yeah,
just
I think
no.
My immediate assumption is I don't think the artifacts are necessarily ghosting. I just genuinely think that even if you have the motion blur, it is just so intense that I'm like convinced it's using DLSS light. Maybe Digital Foundry will cover it later and they'll be able to tell us for sure. But it's like the way the image breaks up in movement reminds me of what they've shown with the DLSS light stuff, which for.
Yeah, I can't tell the upscaling technology. Like I'm not familiar with DLSS besides Switch stuff because I don't have Nvidia hardware. Like the Switch 2 and Switch 1 are the only Nvidia devices I have at home, funnily enough. But I think it's it looked a bit similar to what I was experiencing on Steam Deck because I bought the game on Steam to compare and I refunded it because I don't want to replay it. But it probably was just the Unreal Engine thing they used. But I was happy that it didn't at least have as many hitching things as there was on the PC version, because the PC version is still not fixed. Like even on Steam Deck, it's pretty bad with the like traversal stutter or whatever. So. Game is pretty good. I don't want to replay it though. I'm excited for the sequel for sure, but it's a bit like based on how the game is on other platforms, at least like based on the Digital Foundry video I saw, it's like it's pretty sad that it looked sub 1080p internally on Switch 2 docked when it's like 1440p or whatever on PS4 Pro. Maybe they'll fix it in updates or whatever, but yeah, I'm just happy I got to play it finally, because this is one of those games which I missed it during its launch window and I just kept saying maybe I'll pick it up on sale. Didn't have time, finally played it. So
it's neat. It's a lot harder than I would have expected. I didn't expect some of those final bosses to be quite that intensive, especially when man, I would have really appreciated if there was like gyro aiming or something like that. But maybe gyro aiming with how much input lag this has wouldn't be great.
Yeah, this is based on your preview, you kind of prepped us for that, at least, because when you previewed it, you mentioned how the port was sufficient or whatever, but the input lag was definitely something you had to get used to, and it is true. So
yeah, so you did test it out on Steam Deck. Is it just a game thing, or is it like
the no Switch no port? I mean, I played it on the ROG Ally, and I played it on the OLED deck. Both have like much better screens, and both were running at like 120 and 90, despite me capping it to 30. But the input lag felt more on the Switch 2, regardless.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so it's not. I mean, it probably is a game. The game probably has some baked in lag, but it's definitely more noticeable on the Switch 2 version. And yeah, like
it's bad enough for like one of the last bosses. You're basically expected to parry its attacks, and you cannot hold like parry when you see the animation. You have to be like, okay, I think he's going to do the attack here, and then press the block button, and then that'll parry. That's how bad the input lag is. It's not great, but you can get used to it. But honestly, now that I'm thinking about it, I should have made a bigger point about that in the review, because I mentioned it in the preview and it's still a problem here. And it's like, especially now knowing that it's mostly just the Switch 2 thing, it's like, yeah, no, that is... I wonder...
Yeah, but that's still fine, right? Because you don't need to compare it. Like, having a perspective of just someone who's playing it here without having any other frame of reference is still worthwhile.
Yeah.
That's actually what I did here, because before even downloading it on Steam, I was like, you know, I always do these port reviews by comparing it. Let me first see how it actually feels without knowing anything about the game's performance. So that's an interesting perspective to have, I think, for these releases.
Yeah,
because for a lot of people, they don't have any other devices besides the Switch 2 for these games. So we need to like give that perspective as well.
Yeah, I will say in handheld mode, whatever they're using for the upscaling, I think it works out better in handheld mode than docked. For some reason,
were you playing it on your 4K display?
Yeah, I was playing on my LG. Well, I even mentioned in the review, I was playing, ironically enough, the way I have my desk set up with my TV is actually pretty similar to how things were set up at that preview thing with Nintendo, where they had us setting up right up and close to a 4K TV. So I figured, well, they felt like they were showcasing it, so I'm going to play it this way for the most part, because that is clearly how they felt was a sufficient way to judge the experience of playing the game.
I see, because I was playing on my 1440p monitor, so maybe it bothered me a bit less than if I was playing it on a proper 4K screen.
I will tell you that it's definitely not targeting a 4K output. It's targeting probably like a 1440p output, which means...
Yeah, that's probably... The internal is definitely sub 1080, because I've been learning how to pixel count over the last few weeks and like looking at different stuff. So it's definitely
My bet, just knowing off based off of that, is I'm guessing it is doing a 1:4 upscale. So like I'm assuming that's 540p internally in handheld going up to 1080p, and that's probably 720p going up to 1440p in docked. That would be my guess.
Yeah, that's probably like something I'll look into when I you know, like pixel counting games which have heavy upscaling and post-processing is like a big challenge, as anyone would expect. But because when I was doing this, I was also playing the Tomodachi Life demo on Switch 2. And that is like zero anti-aliasing. It's like the easiest pixel counting thing ever. So yeah, like going from that to this was like, yeah, this is like the final boss almost.
Yeah, I will say also that it did kind of stand out to me. One thing I did check in handheld mode, because I did have like one session, it's very clearly being a little bit conservative in terms of how much power it's drawing in handheld mode for the sake of battery life. Because I did notice that I was able to play almost 2 hours, and I have the battery saving, well, the power, well, the battery life, the battery longevity setting turned on, where it only maxes out like 85% like charge.
Okay.
And after almost 2 hours, I still had like 25-30% battery left, which tells me that from a full charge, it's probably going to be something close to like 3.5 hours.
Yeah, that's a lot better, because like Final Fantasy VII Remake Integrate, I don't know if you've played that on Switch 2. I play on Switch 2 with full brightness always. I think I could probably get like 1 hour, 15 minutes, or like 1.5 hour at best in that game. So like it's, and even Cyberpunk, like these games just don't last more than like an hour, hour and a half or whatever, if you're playing at full brightness compared to like every other device I have at home, which would give me like double or triple. So yeah, like it's good that they did that, but this is one of those cases where I'd have preferred like a toggle for like battery saver or like, you know, quality or performance or something.
Yeah.
This is something which Feral Interactive does really well with their, because they port a lot of stuff to iOS and Android. So when they do the Switch 2 versions and Switch 1 ports, they also add a battery saver option over there for people who want to, like, you know, play for a longer time. But they also do like 120 FPS and stuff. So maybe something like that would be good to have here if they did, in fact, cap it at 30 just to save battery.
Yeah.
Okay.
It also all could right. be, though, that there were some situations where it does dip, even that considered. Like, I only really noticed in handheld mode once where it dipped pretty heavily. There were definitely some moments where it there was, like, a small hitch when something happened, but nothing that was really too bad. I feel like the majority of the time it does hit that 30 FPS target. Like, and by the majority, I mean like 95% of the time. But there was like one moment with the second spirit at the top of a mountain looking down on like basically the full area that you were in, where it was like at the top of like this elevator. And that definitely had some performance issues in handheld mode. I didn't check that section docked. Maybe it's better docked. But in handheld mode, it was like, oh, I can definitely tell that this isn't just dropping frames. They are consistently not hitting that target. So probably a CPU limitation, I'd imagine, since you can see a bunch of stuff from there. So it's not cooling as much.
Yeah, so that's Kena: Bridge of Spirits, and then that had a sequel announced, Kena: Scars of Kazumura, that was announced for PS5 and PC, so not Switch 2 yet, maybe. But that'll launch sometime this year, and that's looking to be like more open world-ish based on its initial reveal. So good on Ember Labs for keeping it going, and maybe we'll see the sequel on Switch eventually. And then to finish off our article shoutouts, I mentioned it already at the beginning. We had Junior have put up a review for Mega Man Star Force Legacy Collection. Scored it pretty high. You know, I'm not a big Star Force person, so I'm definitely new in this regard. I don't know much about them, but it seems like people who are into the Star Force games got, you know, the collection that they've been waiting for forever. Like, it seems to be a very ideal sort of like collection that you'd want to see.
Yeah, he especially praised a lot of like the different like toggles and settings that are available now for people to, you know, kind of adjust to their liking for playstyle and, you know, difficulty and all these things. So that's one thing that he praised quite a bit in his review.
Yeah, I saw some people get emotional when they saw the Mega Man Star Force like menu of like the Star Force design, like speaking. They're like, "Man, I haven't seen this Mega Man in a long time." It got nostalgic. I'm like, "That's cool." All right, main news. We got quite a bit of things that happened this week. It kind of just like built up. I wasn't expecting this much, but I think the most significant one that kind of caught me by surprise was there was a Blue Reflection 9th anniversary stream that happened earlier this week, and the biggest announcement came out of that was Blue Reflection Quartet, and that is releasing on July 30th on PS5, Switch 2, Switch 1, and PC. And then I know you're going to be asking, it's like, Quartet, like, wasn't there only like two Blue Reflection games? And like, yeah, There were two console games, but there's not four either. This has This is kind of a weird one. It has remakes of the Blue Reflection Ray anime, which I did watch, and the Blue Reflection Sun mobile game, both rendered with the in-game 3D graphics of the console game.
Yeah, and so, it seems like there's some control, like, given to you. It's, like, I guess, like, an interactive thing, but not, like, a game itself. But, yeah. It's interesting how, like, there's a number of different reactions I've seen about this. First, on its face, this is very cool. Like, incredibly cool. I haven't played Blue Reflection or Blue Reflection Second Light. I've been meaning to get around to them because I know plenty of people that actually really enjoy those games. But it's really fascinating how, like, depending on how familiar you are with those two new things getting adapted, the reactions are very different. People that just have cursory knowledge, it's like, oh, cool, I can't wait to check those out. And people that are familiar with those are like, god damn it, we're going to see the self-insert dude again.
Yeah, so I'll get into that in a little bit. But for the Blue Reflection Ray one, like, as you mentioned, it's not a fully playable version of the anime. It's like, it's all presented with the in-game console graphics of the Blue Reflection games. It's a condensed version of the story, as they describe the Steam description. And with the major characters rendered in 3D, just a weird way to say that, but it does have, like, the two main characters, Hiyori and Ruka, kind of witness, like, an abridged version of, like, that game's, if, like, that anime's events through the game itself. So it's not a fully playable journey, which is odd, but okay. Like, that was an interesting show. I wouldn't say it's my favorite, but it does have a pretty ballin' second opening. So my biggest thing out of that. And then Blue Reflection Sun is the very it's a very controversial one that in a lot of fans' eyes kind of killed the series, because as James mentioned, like, this series really is very resonant with people who like Yuri, who are lesbians. It's very open about, like, it's Yuri, like, theming, where it's a lot of relationships between, you know, young girls and how they are, like, you know, especially about the trauma they experience and how they confide in each other to overcome their trauma by, you know, seeking, you know, some sort of, like, relationship with one another, especially being, like, within a similar age range, being a similar place in life. Obviously different personalities, but they confided in each other for that. So that was very resonant, and it's still resonant with that crowd. And that was very much apparent in the first Blue Reflection and Second Light, and even in the Ray anime. Sun is very controversial. It was only released in Japan, and this time it starred a male main character, sort of like a nameless male main character that develops relationships with these girls now. And this really, really, really did not land well with the base audience of Blue Reflection. And with this re-release of Sun, that nameless, faceless male main character is still in it, and is like, ugh, man. So
they learn nothing.
Yeah, people don't really like that, because that breaks down, like, the core foundation of, like, the identity of the series in those, you know, fans' eyes, and I totally understand that, you know, because it's definitely, you cannot have a meaningful story, Yuri story, if you're kind of shoving in this dude. Like, fundamentally, you cannot have, like, tell those experiences with, like, So in Quartet's version of Sun, the Steam description describes it as it's been remade as a console game, using the systems of Second Light to recreate memorable battles of the original mobile game, and it tells the story of Sun across 24 events featuring new character interaction. And then the prologue and epilogue from the original release also connect this entry to other works in the series. So once again, it's like a abridged version of it, where you are able to, like, play parts of it, like some of the battles in it and the event series. So it's not a fully, like, remade game in those two new editions. It's like the kind of chopping bits and parts of it into this collection. As for the existing two console games, they do have some improvements mechanically. Like in the first game, they've increased the movement speed and added an autosave to the first game. And then in Second Light, they actually added 8 additional characters from the Ray anime and Sun Mobile game. So they are playable in there and that and through that title. And they've also increased the battle of movement speed and event fast forwarding is available in Second Light. Now, this next part is... It can get pretty murky, and I'll try to navigate through it the best I can. But in this updated Quartet version, since it's being released worldwide simultaneously to a modern audience, a lot of the scenes and outfits in the first game have been more covered up, because in the first game, it was very common for the girls to be stripped down to their like underwear, pretty much. So showed a lot of skin to each other. There's a lot of, like, events, especially in, like, the locker rooms where they are interacting with each other. Some, like, even, like, in the showers, you know, where they weren't really wearing anything. And so in this Quartet version, they've had outfits that cover up more of their bodies. And, you know, it does lead into that, like, sort of, like, usual response from, you know, people who... engage with these games, like, hey, I really like that portion of the game because I really like this is really, you know, there's the aspect that I really enjoyed for, you know, for perverted reasons. But for other fans, you know, it was more resonant with them, were like, it makes sense for, you know, girls of this age to be in a locker room stripped down to their underwear that aren't, like, you know, they aren't like blouses almost. Like, it's totally normal for, you know, girls to occupy this same space with very little with clothing that show very little skin because they're comfortable with one another. You know, it's not meant to be like, you know, the premise and circumstances within the game isn't meant to like elucidate like perverted responses from the girls themselves when interacting with one another. They're just living out their day-to-day experience. And for definitely some fans of the game, like their core audience, like, they enjoyed that Yuri part of it without having to be weird about it, you know? So, like, I'm kind of, like, at this weird, like, crossroads where I do agree with those people who are disappointed that they are censoring the outfits in this regard, because that is kind of one of the core foundations of the game, weirdly enough, where it makes sense for them to be, like, scantily clothed, like, when with each other, because that's a normal... circumstance, normal setting, in that regard.
It also could be a situation where could be ratings boards, it could be platform holders, it could be, yeah, Nintendo, exactly, or Sony. We just it could be Valve. Honestly, I would put money on Valve over anything else, but
it's frustrating. Like, obviously, like, I'm sure PC mods will come out to revert the changes, but for people on the console side, no, they'll have to live with what they get.
And it could be a situation where even if it wasn't Valve directly, they could have, since it's an open secret how Valve is, like, very touchy when it comes to that sort of thing. They just were like, well, we're going to change this quick just to, like, be on the safe side. And it sucks, but I don't think they've explained the specific reason why. And I think there's enough going on with multiple platform holders that I would assume that it's not them doing it to specifically appeal to an audience or something, but rather just more likely some of that stuff, I'd imagine. But
It's a pretty, like, unique series in their regard. Like, hey, it does have, like, we don't really see much, like, magical girl turn-based RPGs, especially one that embraces, like, you know, Yuri themes. And it has, like, a pretty, like, nice, clean, like, UI to it that you really don't see much in other games. There's, like, how it elucidates this, like, feeling of, like, etherealness, very clean, smooth UI, and just in general, like, a very, like, beautiful character artwork on it. So, and Chao, I believe you played Second Light, and you really like Second Light, from what I remember, right?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think Second Light's would be the standout to get on this collection, I would say. The first game is, like, it's fine. It's just a little rough because, you know, it's the first game. They don't really have all the kinks worked out yet, right? So,
yeah.
But I actually have a platinum. I actually have a platinum trophy on the first game, actually. Because I was kind of new at NeoSeeker at the time, and they were looking for, like, guide work, and it's like, is there anything you're interested in? It's like, oh, well, maybe I'll do this. And then that's how I ended up playing Blue Reflection.
Cool.
I
remember, really, like, the music was a standout, too. Like, it had a really nice OST between both games.
You know what I really like in the first game? Like, near what's the end of the game, it's like the world's gonna end, and the title theme just keeps playing, like the title screen theme plays. I really love that. It just, like, it goes, like, extra slow. It makes it more dreading. It's like one of my favorite parts of it.
I have to imagine the purpose of this release is to, like, see, hey, what's the current interest in the Blue Reflection series, and they're trying to put their best foot forward as the best as they can the modern climate, to see what the interest is. So obviously,
I would say I'm very interested in getting this, but I just hope they don't charge people like a fortune, like the Atelier collections, where they, like, $120 asking price.
You know? Well, I mean, it sounds like that they're very quick. They're specifically selling this as only a bundle, not separately. So I think it's different than what they're doing with the, like, say, the Atelier stuff. And I think, put another way, they know they can kind of get away with it to an extent with Atelier. I don't think they can get away with it with Blue Reflection.
So yeah, this will be out July 30th worldwide. So well, hopefully it does well enough to make a new Blue Reflection. I think even though, like, Sun burned up a lot of goodwill, I think it's been far enough. Like, hey, like, we would like you to revisit this, but please don't redo what you did with Sun. You know, please remember, like, the core identity, the series of, like, what we like about it.
I think the problem is that, and I think a lot of folks have correctly identified this, is that they probably considered Sun a correcting of the record of what they originally intended. Yeah.
That'd be a very... If they were to make a new one, I think it would be a very, very, very bad move to have a male protagonist.
I'm hoping you're right, and I'm sure they're hoping you're right too. It's just one of those things where I am not crossing my fingers. Not holding my breath.
But yeah, but it's cool that Blue Reflection is back in a big way very soon. This was revealed, I believe, at the Xbox Partner Preview. Developer Taeon, published by Nacon, they have announced Hunter the Reckoning Death Wish, that is set to release next year for PlayStation 5, Xbox Series, and PC. This is by, as people know, Taeon developed RoboCop Rogue City and Terminator Resistance, both pretty well received. They have a pretty solid track record in that regard. Adam, were you able to learn about Hunter the Reckoning Deathwish?
Yeah, so Hunter the Reckoning is one of those World of Darkness properties, like Vampire the Masquerade or Werewolf the Apocalypse. It's always something to something, right? In this case, it's Hunter the Reckoning. There were a few, like, hack and slash sort of, like, combat games, like, on the PlayStation 2 and original Xbox, like, 20 years ago. But this is the first game in that kind of property since then, Deathwish. And this game is first-person action RPG, and there was a post on Xbox Wire from the creative director of the game saying, kind of explicitly, this is inspired by Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, the original one. And he even calls it, like, a slower-paced game, where, like, if you play the original Bloodlines, it's, you know, there's not a lot of combat. And in fact, most people would argue that the combat is bad. And you don't even get EXP from combat in that game. It's all about quests and dialogue and characters. And it seems like that is the biggest inspiration to this game. So yeah, it's another. There's been some pretty bad World of Darkness games recently. So here's hoping this one is on the stronger end of it. They have the right inspirations. And they have a pretty good pedigree, like you said, with Terminator Resistance and RoboCop Rogue City. And yeah, we'll see how it turns out coming out next year.
So, look, man, after Bloodlines 2, people are searching for anything right now. So, Like you said, like hopefully this lands, and you know, like with a pretty, like I said, pretty solid track record, I think people are right to feel confident, but also, you know, a bit cautious as well.
Yeah, they say their main inspirations are Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, the first one, the TV show Supernatural, which I've heard a lot about. I haven't seen it myself, so I'm not exactly sure what that means. And then also Baldur's Gate 3, which is, you know, a good inspiration to have, I suppose, for some of the RPG mechanics. So, yeah.
Next up, there was a shareholder meeting with that Pearl Abyss had. And Pearl Abyss CEO, sorry if I'm mispronouncing this, Heo Jin Young, revealed that they are currently in the R&D phase of Crimson Desert on the Switch 2. That is a one hell of a game to bring onto the Switch 2. I was like, can the Switch 2 even run it?
Can possible? The Steam Deck run it? Which I think Mikhail's answer to that was no.
Yeah, so I don't know. Good luck, I guess. That's exciting if you can pull it off, you know? Like, that is definitely I don't want to say the ultimate handling, but it will definitely consume your time if you're looking to burn time on the go, if you can get it to run well. And I'm thinking, like, one of the biggest hurdles as well, besides performance, is just, like, on-screen text, because the text there's a lot of text on the screen, and I imagine that gets pretty freaking small on the Switch 2 screen. So they're going to have to really make sure that things are easily readable on the Switch 2 and handheld. So, good luck there. Though they did also reveal that Crimson Desert has now sold over 3 million copies. That's it's doing quite well. I see a lot of people sharing info on day-to-day, it feels like, of like things that they found, crazy things that they found in the game, or things that you can do, which is, like I said, always the fun, the most fun part about a game's release, especially on this scale, is like people finding things on their own or sharing things on their own and like saying like, oh, it's so sick that you can do this, or I found this, and it's like, just in like the last hour, I saw someone find like a backpack that dispenses chocolates in that game. I'm like, okay, that's crazy. But I've also found people like find like interesting movement tech in that game to scale up things fast with the aerial stab mechanic or ability in that game, so like you can kind of almost fly in that game through that ability, which is interesting. So it's fun to see you know, people experience the game and find the game all sorts of crazy things in their own way. I also saw like a quote from the CEO from the shareholder meeting running like around, basically apologizing for how the narrative, like the storytelling and the story of this game being not up to their expectations, and basically saying sorry for like, hey, it was something that was,
we wanted to prioritize
gameplay first.
If I had a nickel for every like, South Korean dev that released a breakout hit on PS5 and PC in the last several years that had to apologize for the story being kind of nothing in their games, I'd have two nickels, which isn't a lot, but it's weird that it happened twice.
Well, what was the last one? It was Stellar Blade.
It was Stellar Blade. Yeah, they did straight up say that the sequel for Stellar Blade is going to have a much more like cohesive narrative, because they even agreed that like Stellar Blade's narrative was just kind of nothing.
Yeah. That was like one of the big weaknesses in that game for sure. Like in Crimson Desert. So hopefully,
I mean,
a much better place.
I mean, I'm sure that in like South Korea, like they've seen how one of the things that people say is the best part of Lies of P is like, man, this story is genuinely really fucking good.
I was actually just thinking like a meme, like the virgin Stellar Blade versus the Chad Lies of P. Sorry.
You're right to say it.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of like other like home released like South Korean developed games. Like I'm like thinking like the first Descendant didn't have a great story. Like, oh, what else did? But yeah, Lies of P. Excellent.
Especially Witcher. Man, what a damn good expansion.
But yeah, more to say on, you know, Lies of P, hopefully in the future. Like, I know they're definitely working on a full-fledged follow-up, and we're excited for that. Next up, one of the big headliners in the Xbox partner preview event this week was RGG Studio revealed a new trailer for Stranger Than Heaven and revealed that it'll launch on PS5, Xbox, and PC. So we do have Xbox Series and PC. So we do have the platforms now for that game. They also revealed that there will be another event for Stranger Than Heaven on May 6th, where they're going to show more details about that game. One of the big like narrative details they revealed in that new trailer, though, was this will span across five cities throughout five different eras. So it is a time travel story in that regard, where the I forgot exactly which time periods they showed on the screen, but they had like different like decades of Japan and different eras, like, you know, technological and social wise throughout different cities. One of them was Kamurocho, showed the familiar gate that the Yakuza series, you know, definitely often showed throughout the game. So
the years are 1915, 1929, 1943, 1951, and 1965.
Thank you. Yeah, I think people already got an inkling this would be maybe, it's still you know, jury is still out on this, but still maybe somewhat connected to Yakuza, because the initial showings of this was it's like the Sotenbori map, that were in the RGG games. Then this one obviously, you know, shows Kamurocho. Like, for me personally, I still really wish that this was his own thing and not related to the
RPG games. I always hope that.
I will say that having, like, the part in Kamurocho be 1965 means it probably won't have that much overlap, yeah. I'd imagine.
I saw some people kind of speculating, maybe half-jokingly, maybe not. Like, what if it, like, ends with, like, a reveal of, like, Kiryu's dad or something?
Yeah, people are saying like it's like maybe it's like the origin story of that Doji faction or the Tojo clan. I'm like, I don't want any of this, man. I want it to be its own cool thing.
I agree.
Best case would be that they have Kamurocho, but they don't actually deal with the main stuff of the Yakuza, like the Yakuza games, and it's just like there as a setting, and it's like, hey, I know this place, and then they just. It's like a little nod, and that's it. That would be the ideal. I don't expect it to be that, but hey, I can hope.
Yeah, they also apparently like in the thumbnail and in the trailer, they showed like they had Snoop Dogg in the game. I guess he had like he did mocap for it back like in 2024, and they had a picture of him in the studio. So
I'm fully expecting that they're going to reveal the release date at that May thing, and it's going to be like, coming this fall, it's our big holiday release, and it's like, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sega doesn't have a whole lot upcoming. Well, I guess they have like all their like revival retro franchise stuff that apparently is in the works, but we haven't actually like seen that.
No.
And there's Persona Shinobi. 4.
Yeah, we got Shinobi, that released. It did well critically. I don't know how well it did commercially, but...
I just meant for, like, upcoming big releases for this year. What does Sega have? It's probably this. And maybe, like, do we think, like, Persona 4 Revival is this year? I mean, what they showed for that so far was not a lot, so maybe not.
I'm going to be willing to bet that it's not this year, but it will probably be, like, a February release.
Yeah, I could see that.
We'll see. So that is Stranger Than Heaven. I still think the game looks sick, but just like, but RGG Studio has
talked. Yeah, I've definitely seen some hesitation just in general based on how they've treated the Yakuza series recently. So
bummer, but well, hopefully, you know, hope for the best for that. Other news in the RPG space here, we have Saga series illustrator Satoshi Kuramochi has left Square Enix. They left Square Enix back in February and now going freelance. This is something that we've seen more and more happen. Like, I remember Shoji Meguro did this some years back, leaving Atlas and going freelance.
Yeah, a lot of composers do this. But yeah, I think illustrators and artists too. Really, it makes sense. Like, you get a little bit more autonomy. They can still work with Square Enix, you know, they obviously have to just negotiate their own like contract and rates and whatnot. But then they can work for anyone else too. So
yeah. Yep. So for people don't remember, Kuramochi, did the illustration for, Scarlet Grace and Emerald Beyond, mostly in that regard, but also did, Imperial Saga, Romancing Saga Reuniverse. Very, you know, their art style.
I think he also helped out on like, was it World of Final Fantasy a little bit too?
Yeah. They also, I believe, did like a recent art piece celebrating the release of the City at Duellum. Like, I believe a lot of like,
yeah, Square Enix does that a lot, where they have all their artists or contributors do like congratulations or anniversary art or whatever. So
yeah, sometimes like companies will just, even for people not just directly related to the game's development, they'll actually hire like a. Like artists on like socials to do stuff. Like I have a friend of mine who did some like Katamari art for like to commemorate that recent Once Upon a Katamari release last year.
Oh yeah, cool.
And I think the main HD2D artist whose name I'm forgetting, like he did like a Paranormasite like thing, you know, just kind of congratulating that art, and then something with the Elliot game. Like they do these crossover art things. It's fun.
Yep. So best of luck and to your next endeavors, Kuramochi. We are rooting for you. You're awesome. And next up, we have an official announcement from Nice America that they are bringing over what was the previously Hono Gurashi no Niwa in Japan. They are localizing the name to Village of the Shade, and they are releasing it in the West for PS5, Switch 2, Switch 1, and PC. So this is like a physical, I mean, unofficial announcement for that. As for the physical side of things, Mikhail wrote up that the Switch 2 is a game key card for the Switch 2 physical side of it. And also they have the usual limited edition stuff here. I forgot if this is already... Okay, this hasn't released in Japan yet. Still at the end of July for that
one. Yeah. It's noteworthy that the PC version does not list its supporting English, so it might be a situation where they might release the Japanese version first again. Now, what I've told people I know at NIS America is if you're going to do that shit again, it's probably best to label it as early access, and then when the English version gets ported in, just release it out of early access, but...
This happened I don't in know East there's... 10, right? The base East 10 release?
East 10 and Trails Through Daybreak.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like one of those things where they might be pulling again, and it might be like internal politics, but it's like they know, and NIS America at least knows, that that would be the way to do it.
This game might be smaller scale, smaller scope, that maybe they figure it's fine.
Well, here's the thing. I don't know if you've been paying attention, well, keeping up on how well, like, the trailers for this have been trafficking on, like, YouTube, like, in Japan. But all signs are pointing to this potentially being the big break that NIS has been looking for, because there's a lot of interest in this title in Japan. There's a lot of interest in this title in Japan.
Interesting. I know people really like the Yomiwari series, but... I wonder what it is about this game that's really catching people's eyeballs now.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's cool. It has a really good aesthetic. Yeah,
for an example, the most recent trailer that released on NIS's YouTube a month ago, I'm going to, without looking it up, guess how many views the trailer on the NISJ YouTube channel has right now. The most recent one.
500k? I don't know.
Higher.
800?
Double that.
Okay. Alright. So like almost 2 million. Then.
Yeah.
Oh. Crazy.
So there's a very real... I'm sure they're hoping that it translates at all into sales, because they need a massive success.
Interesting.
I don't know if this is interesting or useful, but NIS America is at PAX East this weekend. They're showing Etrange Overlord, which is already out, but they're just showing it because why not? They're showing Brigadine Abyss. There's even like a panel with the producer there. They're showing Disgaea Mayhem, which has a different title in Japan. I forget what it is. And I remember someone telling me that they actually have this game not playable, but it's got like, it's not like a demo, like a trailer reel if they're showing it. So
next up, you have an interesting announcement. Adam, you broke this. EverQuest Legends was announced that it's coming to PC in this July. This is like a reimagined version of EverQuest that is more friendly to solo play. There are just a quality of life and enhancements to it that allows for better solo play. I you'll have more details, so tell me about it.
Yeah, so this is one of the appointments I had at GDC that I was embargoed until they announced it this week, this past week. So I will say that I'm not personally familiar with EverQuest. I did have friends who played it growing up. The EverQuest, the original MMORPG, released in 1999. EverQuest 2 released in 2004. And both of those games still run today. They still get updates. They still have, you know, they still have official websites and official like communications and patches and news, like, you know, forums, not maybe not forums, but like they get updated. It's all handled by Daybreak Game Company, which is they used to be known as Sony Online Entertainment before they kind of spun off and became their own thing. And so I met with them at GDC, and they basically have come to an agreement with some of like the modding team and private server, like fans of EverQuest, like people who have been playing EverQuest their whole lives, to do a new release of EverQuest. To be clear, this is not EverQuest 3. This is not EverQuest Next, which was like a game that was announced like more than 10 years ago that never saw light of day. But basically, I talked with both the Daybreak team as well as Game John, which is sort of this new independent kind of fan-led studio making EverQuest Legends. The idea is that kind of twofold. One, EverQuest has changed a lot in how it looks and how it feels over, you know, the 20 years of its life. So one of the goals with EverQuest Legends is to make it look like it did originally. So if you look at screenshots for this game, it looks old. If you look at the UI to this game, it looks old. But that's sort of the point, is it's meant to be nostalgic. It's meant to be like, here's what EverQuest looked like back in 1999. So in that sense, it does feel a little bit like, in the same vein as old school RuneScape or World of Warcraft Classic. Not exactly like those, but you know, it's meant to be like a reimagined nostalgia type game. But the other component to what the premise of this new release is that if you wanted to play EverQuest right now, there's a pretty high hurdle to doing that, because the way that game is structured and formatted, it is a true blue MMORPG. And some of the content in that game to get through it cannot be soloed easily. So you got to find people to play with. You got to find large groups. If you're doing raids, that's at least like 40 people. And, you know, just the state of the game, while it's still active, that's just harder and harder to do. And so there's a big hurdle to entry, a big barrier to entry if you wanted to play EverQuest today. So that's the other goal to this release, is like, hey, we want a version of EverQuest that you can play by yourself, or maybe with just like four other or three other people. I believe, if I remember correctly, like a normal like adventuring party is now four people, just four at max, but you can play solo. And then if you're doing a raid, that's eight people. So basically all scaled down, but they powered up your playable character that you're making a lot, that you can basically progress through the game by yourself without as much issue. They're adding multi-classing that was not in the original game. So you can have three classes at once. And they emphasized to me that like your three classes that you're having, or that you're embodying in your character, they're not like depowered in any way. It's literally like you're playing like three characters at once, all powered up. And it allows you to play the game solo, allows you to, you know, have a lot more, you know, mix and matching in terms of how you play the game. And something that you could feasibly, and this is the whole idea, just start a game, start playing, play by yourself, and progress by yourself. And you can't do that with EverQuest as it is. So I've seen actually a fair bit of excitement for this. Usually a lot from people who have played EverQuest, so like fans of the game. But even from people, I've seen some excitement, just like, you know, like Junior, for instance, in our chat, who likes these sorts of MMO games, he's like, hey, this would be a perfect way to maybe jump in and experience the game, with the understanding that like this is not going to be exactly EverQuest as it was. Like, that's not the point. But it's like a version of EverQuest that you can actually play today with relative ease compared to what EverQuest itself, which still exists. You can buy it if you want. You can play it if you want. But this is a new version that's meant to be an easier entry point, as well as nostalgic. So I think it's an interesting concept. It's an interesting project. I'm not entirely sure, you know, the breadth of the appeal to how many people find this something they want to try. But it's definitely, I think it has the right genesis, and that they're literally the team making it are like fans of EverQuest, you know, people who are very familiar with it, people who know, you know, what excites them and what the strengths of the game and things like that. And the person at Daybreak Games, the publisher that I talked to, basically said the reason why he even worked or got hired at Sony Online Entertainment years ago before it even changed name was because he was a huge EverQuest fan. So it's like, that's kind of the angle that this is coming from. I know Daybreak Games has not necessarily the best track record. I'm not familiar personally with that, but I know, you know, some of the decisions they've made and how they've run EverQuest have not been necessarily warmly received by everyone. But this does seem like something that is people are curious about.
Yeah. That's an interesting endeavor, especially like just this, like you said, this whole like trend of like classic versions of MMOs being re-released for a modern crowd, and the bells and whistles that entails.
And I wonder,
very, very crazy.
I wonder if some of that noise about Square Enix like considering possible new 11 expansions is actually them looking at this and thinking, what if we like can make 11 in a more usable state for people to go back to and make in like a, because lots of people play on private servers for 11 that are like more like older versions of it. Maybe they're thinking that might be a quick and easy way to get some more money coming in if we can get like convert some of those people to play like paying an actual sub.
They should stop being cowards and do FF14 1.0.
Nightmare.
This is actually kind of a fun, I don't know how to put this, but one of the voice actors from Final Fantasy 14, Senna Breyer, who I think voices Wuk Lamott. Is that right?
Yes, you are correct.
They were one of the people who showed a lot of excitement for this EverQuest Legends. So I saw that. That's fun.
That's cool.
Sen is cool. I've met her at a couple of events, and the hatred that has spilled over to her because some people don't like her character and vice versa, the hatred towards that character because she is trans. If you're listening to this podcast, I expect that you're not part of those groups, but if you are, you should leave.
Yeah. I mean, if you're still listening to us after we've had like transgender participants and on this podcast and you don't like it, like, why are you still listening to us? You know, that's we support all that.
Yeah.
Next up, we have a pretty substantial news concerning the price of the PlayStation coming in the very near future. Sony has announced by Isabel Tomatis, not sure how to pronounce that, Vice President Global Marketing at Sony Interactive Entertainment, has announced a price increase in the US, the UK, in Europe, and Japan starting April 2nd. And it's a
I love the one post on Blue Sky from Matt Kim, formerly of IGN, who's just summed it up. My PS5, from now on referred to as the asset, is doing better than my 401k.
Yeah, so the price increase is kind of crazy across the board in terms of like, you know, like the base PS5 in the US going from $499 to now $650, so that's about a 30% increase. The digital version without the disc tray on the PS5 has a plus 50% increase, going by going from $399 to $599.
It's
just,
even
just, no, just want to think one more. Just need to say one thing, that this is not the actual price increase which has happened right now. This is comparing the launch prices to now, because they've had price increases already. Yeah. So yeah, just to be clear, that they haven't like gone up by like whatever $200 or $300 immediately.
The other thing that I did mention on Blue Sky is that, remember when the PS4 Pro launched at the original PS4 price because the PS4 got a price drop?
Yeah, I remember buying the PS4 Pro was like exactly what I paid for the original PS4.
Which is, and the PS4 at that time was like
super cheap. Yeah.
Yeah. And but now, like, a digital PS5 at launch was $400. A PS5 Pro now, which is a digital PS5, you don't have the disc drive, you don't have the stand, it doesn't come with a stand, it's $900 in a week. That is insane. A PS5 Pro...
For the digital, the new price is $600.
No, I'm talking about the digital Pro? At launch for the regular PS5 was $400. Versus the PS5 Pro now is going to be $900. Okay. Yeah. Because I'm comparing like that same situation with the PS4 versus the PS4 Pro back then.
Yeah.
You could have gotten a PS4 Pro for the same price as the launch price of a base PS4. You cannot get a PS5 Pro. You have to spend over twice as much to get a PS5 Pro now versus the price of a base digital PS5 at launch. Insane. Insane.
Yeah, I'm going to be the PS5 Pro, which I'm going to get very soon, is going to cost literally double of what I paid of the PS4 Pro back when, I think I got it in 2018. So yeah, not great.
Yeah, so someone tracked, made a table for the launch prices and the new prices. And the most substantial percentage increase from this is the digital PS5 in Japan, the one without a disc tray and a stand. The launch price for that was 39,980 yen, and now its new price with this price increase is going to be 89,980 yen. So that's a plus 50k yen increase, and the percentage increase there, as they marked, was 135.1% increase from on launch price versus the new price, which is very, very crazy. it's getting tougher and tougher to get a new console these days, man.
As Daniel and Mod said on Blue Sky literally a few like hours ago, it's great that Nintendo said that they're not raising the price of the Switch to this fiscal year. Bad news, this fiscal year ends in 2 days.
Yeah, a lot of Japanese companies, their fiscal years start on April 1st.
Yeah. So if you can't afford it, don't force yourself to. But if you can cut it and you want a Switch 2, I'm gonna be real. If you can afford it and you want one in the next like year or so, you should probably just bite the bullet now. We do not know when the price is gonna rise, but chances are likely it's sooner than later.
I think they're trying their best to like whatever. Like instead of raising the price of the actual console, they've been raising everything else. Like the Joy-Cons are like what, $100 or something for the, it's like a scam, the price for that. And then
the accessories for Switch 2.
I remember.
Amiibo is like $40 for the Street Fighter Amiibo, and they're like on clearance. Yeah. No one's buying that shit. So like, they've raised everything else, and we'll get to what else they've raised soon.
Yeah. So that's the news on Sony stuff. So if you're still holding out for a PS5, You might want to think about that very, very soon. If you have the funds.
One thing I will say, if you've held out, unless you very specifically want to play Ghost of Yote and Saros, one thing you should understand is that one of the things from the Insomniac leak is that Sony was contractually obligated to do PC ports for their Marvel games. So Wolverine will get a PC port regardless of recent events.
Oh, is that real?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay. Well,
if you wanted a PS5 for Wolverine, maybe just wait.
I want to see what happens with that, because Shreya has been adamant on that not happening. So we'll see. But we probably won't know for at least like a year and a half. So
yeah. Also, like it's like I said, that whole situation just feels like them floundering, because especially if the price of like AAA releases, let alone the fact that those Marvel games, they have to pay a cut of the license for every copy sold. That math don't math. They're gonna have to like get that money back somehow, and I definitely think that in the long run they might backtrack. But we'll see.
Then, as you guys foreshadowed, Nintendo also has some price news of their own. Not necessarily the consoles themselves, but this is per the Video Games Chronicle. Nintendo confirms its US Switch 2 games will soon cost more as physical versions. So, Donkey Kong Bonanza retails for $70 physically digitally, while Mario Kart World is $80 physically digitally. So it's been consistent between the physical and digital versions, but now beginning in May, starting with Yoshi and the Mysterious Book, the price of Yoshi and the Mysterious Book digital and physical will be different, and it'll be, I'm trying to see if they have the prices here to reflect it, but I believe like the Yoshi's digital version is going to be 70 or 60?
No, 60. No. 60. It's basically what happened is when they put up pre-orders and they released the trailer for the Yoshi game in Europe, in Japan, and in the UK, and even Australia, I believe, but I'm not sure about Australia, the price was less than what they charged for Mario Tennis Fever digitally, and physical was more expensive. Now, the physical-digital discrepancy has been a thing in all those regions since the start of the Switch 2 gen. So, for them, it's not a big deal. But people extrapolated based on this that it's going to be a $60 game. And there was like all celebration online that Nintendo learned from Tennis and Yoshi is going back to a quote-unquote budget price. Like, remember when budget meant 40 and not 60? But that's another topic. So, Nintendo didn't actually put pre-orders for this until like literally this week when they announced that they're going to have like prices for Switch 2 exclusive software published by Nintendo. The physical versions are going to cost more. And they used it with, like, they announced this with Yoshi, which is 60 and 70 as like, and people are celebrating that like now this means digital games are going to be cheaper and physical is going to remain like that. My prediction for this is they did it with Yoshi because like the discussion online like is exactly what they wanted. When Fire Emblems revealed at 70 digital and 80 physical, that's what my prediction is going to be, that they're just going to follow how this is in other regions, because in Europe, while digital is cheaper than physical, it's still more expensive than Switch 1 physicals and digitals were in the first place. So it got like a soft price increase across the board, which is what James was speculating about on Blue Sky as well.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that on paper, it's just like bringing North America in line with the rest of the regions. But it's definitely, I'm not going to blame anyone that looks at this and it's like, okay, what's the catch? And the catch is probably like, instead of both versions being 60, they want to get that $70 out of the physical version. They want to get more money per game, even if I think that's very silly. And they're just like, okay, well, if we can get 10 bucks more, not even 10 bucks more retail, they're going to try for it.
Yep, it's fun pricing discussions and such. It's not the times that we live in. Next up, I think it's the last of new pricing news this week, thankfully. Next up, we have a fun bit of news. Acacia, who are the developers of Magical Girl Witch Trials, who is only available in Japan, only in Japanese language, as of now. In their most recent broadcasting station episode, I think it's like episode 6, they announced the official localization of Magical Girl Witch Trials coming in English, Korean, French, and Spanish. So there was some talk and some news, in several interviews saying that they were planning to release it in English and other languages. But now they've officially confirmed that along with the other languages. They didn't provide a release date as of yet. But, you know, it's just very good news because this visual novel has been very positively received since its release. And some of the people who are working on the localization in English, went to their socials and, celebrated that they, can confirm that they've been working on it. Seems to be a very talented group. I'm mutuals with some of them. I'm very, very, very happy for them that they got the chance to reveal that they were working on this and very excited to read, when this all comes out in English. Been a fascinating thing to kind of see around the edges, but not try to dig too close. I don't want to get spoiled either in that regard. Hopefully this we'll see some great, reception and numbers for this when those updates, localization updates come out. I'm definitely going to pick it up when it comes and it gets a date. Next up, we have a trailer from a new project for RPG Maker from Gacha Gacha Games. That's an interesting one because this new upcoming RPG Maker is making the jump to HD2D now. So this trailer just, it's hopping on the popular trend of, hey, let people make their own HD2D games. And the trailer shows off something that you'd see like from a Dragon Quest 1 and 2 remake, Octopath Traveler style, HD2D style, So that's a lot of fun in that regard. I'm trying to see if there's anything else that's noteworthy here. But yeah, the most recent one is RPG Maker Unite, as Kite reported. And that's available for purchase on Unity Asset Store, RPG Maker Official Store, and Epic Games Store. Next up, we have, we already mentioned War of the Visions going out, end of service. Another end of service announcement, but this time it's from Bethesda. The Elder Scrolls Blades, which first released in June 2019, is finally closing down on June 30th. This year, and then I believe it's delisted now, so any new download, it's unavailable for new purchases, but people who still play it, everything in the in-game store is now available for like one gem or one sigil, so if they want to progress through whatever they need to see the, I don't know if there's an end to it, they can do so at a very cheap price.
Someone made the observation that the Elder Scrolls Blades was basically announced, released, lived, and died all in the time period since Elder Scrolls 6 was announced. Because that was in 2018.
That's true,
at
yeah.
At E3. That was, wow. If you don't remember, Elder Scrolls 6 was announced at the same time as Starfield, because it was like back-to-back announcements way back when. So we haven't seen anything since.
Well, that's supposedly the next project that they're working on since after the release of Starfield.
Yeah, yeah. It would have to be. Unless any had, day like, now. Fallout. I know people have been wondering about like Fallout remasters, but even if there was one, it probably would be a different studio. I'm not sure. I'm sure Bethesda would contribute, but yeah, this all signs point to that is their next thing.
Yeah. Who knows what that'll be out. next up, this was also at the Xbox partner preview. They showed off Owlcat Games, so showed off new footage of The Expanse, Osiris Reborn, introducing gameplay and companions. So this is yet another, studio who are making their own, massive. And they even cited.
It's actually kind of weirdly coincidental how this turned out in that there's Exodus and this game coming out both supposedly next year. They're both like kind of going for that Mass Effect style, which honestly I'm fine with. There aren't a ton of games in that style. So like I think I said last week, there hasn't really been one since Andromeda, which is a while ago now. Now, the Exodus game, which they actually just released like another gameplay clip like this last week. They did the fuller gameplay reveal a week before. But that one actually has like actual Mass Effect like DNA on it, like working on the game, where the Expanse, they are just inspired by Mass Effect, but like explicitly so. Like they say so in their press releases, they say so in their press briefings. Like, we are Mass Effect fans and we are making this game. So like they are not shy about it. And people have actually pointed out kind of the similarities between like BioWare going from like Baldur's Gate games, you know, like CRPG type games, to games like Mass Effect being more like a third person RPG, where this is Alcat doing kind of the same thing with, you know, Pathfinder and Warhammer Rogue Trader being CRPGs, and this is their first attempt at like a, you know, a third person cover shooter RPG in this case. But I actually have seen people both excited by and also kind of disparaged by that we have two Mass Effect kind of, you know, flavored games coming out next year in this one and Exodus.
Exodus.
Yep.
And the closed beta. Go for it.
Oh, yeah, there is a closed beta in April. Yeah. It's available to those who, like, purchase, like, the special editions on their website. It's available for all the platforms, so PlayStation, Xbox, and PC. But they also revealed, like, the main cast to this game. So if you look at our website, it has like icons, pretty nice art of each of the characters that are that basically are your companions in the game, and it seems like they work similarly to Mass Effect in that they're not people you control, but they are kind of like work alongside you and have special abilities that you can activate in certain situations.
Closed beta starts on April 22nd, available to those who purchase the collector's edition or Miller's pack on the web. That is on Steam, Xbox Series, and PS5. There was also a follow-up report I saw on IGN that the Alcat Games is employing generative AI for this game, not necessarily at the front-facing end for consumers, not to say like art or anything that people will see, but like on like the back-end side, like placeholders, and stuff like that.
Kind of murky waters there. It seems like there was like some sort of like press briefing that we were not invited to, but other like outlets were able to like ask questions about the Expanse to Alcat, and I'm sure someone asked them about generative AI, and this was their response. Even if it's not like planned to be in the final game, it's still kind of like, you know, got to be careful. It gives me the eebie-jeebies a bit. Like, what exactly are you using it for? Right?
So. Yeah.
Is that that?
So, their direct quote was, it was, everything in the final version will be definitely 100% be human made. But they're trying out things on a technical level. For example, looking how 2D image looks in 3D, or changing colors to what looks good, basically to what is being able to iterate faster, and what we don't use to write. We don't use AI voice actors, so everything will be in the final version. I'll definitely 100% be human made. That quote was from Pop VR manager Katharina Pop. That's that.
Yep.
Let's see some release dates upcoming in the near future. Pokemon Champions is coming out April 8th for Nintendo Switch and Switch 2. They say while the game, Mikhail wrote up, while the game will be free, there will be a starter pack bundle releasing on that day with added Pokemon storage space, an extra battle song, and more. Switch 2 players will get a free upgrade providing clearer graphics. And then there's an infographic for people who use Pokemon Home. People can transfer, obviously, Pokemon Go, Scarlet and Violet, and ZA Legends stuff into Pokemon Home, and then they can use Pokemon Home to send that roster into Pokemon Champions, and for Pokemon Champions, they can send it back to Pokemon Home. There's a whole ecosystem that, you know, Pokemon Home users are, you know, should be familiar with in that regard. They can interface that with Pokemon Champions. Pokemon Champions, obviously, is that Pokemon Stadium / Coliseum upcoming spinoff that's very... the main focus of it is Pokemon battles with live players, PvP. So yeah, that'll be coming very soon. Hades 2 is coming to PlayStation 5 and Xbox on April 14th. So people can go experience one of the best games that came out last year in that regard. Still, I assume they're still updating it. I haven't revisited it a bit now, but I assume Supergiant is still working on it.
They've posted the new animated studio who did the anime style thing. It looks pretty nice as usual. There is some like new dialogue at the end, but we don't know what that means because I haven't seen that in the game and I played like a shitload of it. I assume when the new ports come out, they might do a patch for the others to just add some side stuff or whatever. But the main thing which everyone wanted them to fix or change or whatever was done like a few months after. They haven't really like tweaked much beyond that. So I'm curious what like how these versions run. I'll probably try and cover it though because like I just want an excuse to play Hades 2 again. So,
and then also
you would hope that especially considering how easy that they are to run on PC. Surely the PS5 and Series X versions will be 4K 120, right? Surely.
So, So when they did Hades 1, like just some background, at that time it was a 720-60 target game on Switch docked and handheld. And that game just ran like, I was playing it at 144 FPS on my Steam Deck connected to my monitor. So when the PS5 and Series X versions came at 4K 60, I was kind of disappointed because I thought, you know, like, why are they not 4K 120? But then when Hades 2 came to Switch 2, it was 1080 60 handheld and 1080 120 docked. And even this feels a bit conservative because like you can get way above that on Steam Deck and the Steam Deck is not as powerful as a Switch 2 docked. So I assume it's just going to be like 4K 120 is probably a given. But to be honest, I feel like they should be one of those devs doing like 8K downsampled 120 or whatever based on just how it runs on PC. But the only downside is no cross save, so I'm going to have to start from scratch. While like I just sync my save between Switch 2 and Steam Deck now. So yeah, it's gonna be like playing the slow opening and all. I'll deal with it.
I will say that like it feels like every time I hear something new about Hades 2 since I finished it, I wish I had not played Hades 2 until it came to PS5 and Xbox, because then it's like, oh, finally a good time for me to have gotten the best experience out of Hades 2. Still pissed.
I mean, I'm thinking about that for Crimson Desert ending right now.
Oh my god, yeah.
And then also the last announcement we have from the news also comes from the Xbox partner preview event. Wuthering Waves is coming to Xbox as a Play Anywhere title this July. Yeah, then that's already been available on mobile devices, PC and PS5, so getting an Xbox release. Who knows if it'll come to Switch eventually, but who knows? But as for now, Xbox can join the train.
And Wuthering Waves is on Steam, right?
Yes.
Like what, not all of those types of games.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good Steam releases, but that one did.
It initially released as its own PC client, and then it came to Steam some like maybe like 4 to 5 months after, maybe a little bit more. So took some time, but yeah. So yeah, then that wraps up the news and this podcast. You can find us over at rpgsite.net. You can follow our socials, whether it's on Twitter, Blue Sky, etc. Search for RPG Site. You can visit our YouTube where all these podcast episodes are uploaded via rpgsite.net. You can listen to us on your favorite podcast app on your mobile device. And you can join our Discord at discord.gg/rpgsite. To be very active. People are excited for all sorts of stuff. Currently, there's been a breakthrough in the Final Fantasy VIII code to allow easier modding, because that game has been a legacy nightmare for a very long time now to get mods into it. So people have been excited about that. Other than that, what are we expecting in the upcoming week? Any interesting games coming out? I mean, Aether and Iron comes out on the 30th or 31st, I believe, so people can...
Yeah, I don't have any April releases like before the 7th. I'm sure there's something, but I don't have anything listed. There's like a pixel art Western Souls-like type game called Tomb Water that's coming out in a couple of days.
People Note is out on the 7th.
Yeah, that's what I said. There's a couple of things coming out on the 7th, but that's the week after next. So
yeah, it looks like there's no RPGs per se, but it seems like that Konami game, Darwin's Paradox, is April 2nd.
The octopus game.
Yeah.
It's a free-for-all next week. Finally, go play different games.
Someone report back on Octopus Game for next week's podcast.
Yeah.
True.
Yeah.
Until next time, stay safe, take care, and have a great one.